Hello, hello. Good morning, everybody. I am calling to order our Neighborhood Community Affairs meeting beginning May 20th. Joining us today, we have Commissioners Samuelin. I know Commissioner Gongora is on his way, and Commissioner Alaman is here. I just want to make a quick announcement. Item number 2 regarding undergrounding for Upper North Bay Road has been deferred. And there's an addendum that was added from last meeting dealing with the hotel and panic button, and that will be taken up after we have a full dais. Any other announcements or anything? Yes, I just mentioned that. Perfect. Great. So out of respect to my colleague who'd like to be here and is running a few minutes late, we are going to take items that are not his sponsored items, and we'll start, we'll work a little backwards. Item number 13, discussing the increasing the duration of public notice for specimen trees. Commissioner Alaman, since you're here.
Yes.
Let's do your items.
And is the appropriate staff here as well? Anyone here to talk about new? Well, so Commissioner Malikoff and I are working on an entire revised program for heritage trees, and this is one component of that, which is to consider for specimen trees whether we increase the notice period. Currently, it's 1 week, and specimen trees, by definition, are sort of the oldest, most magnificent, most important, historic specimen trees in the city. And as such, residents feel very attached to them, and they do place an important role in our city. So I've asked for the duration to be increased. I think doubled would be good, and would like to see an ordinance prepared as such.
Okay.
I'm sort of stalling to see where the tree people are. But I've run out of words to say very slowly.
Commissioner Samuelin, do you have any thoughts on this issue? You supportive?
Yes.
Listen, we're all supportive. I think we've had background on this item already. If you'd like them to prepare an ordinance and bring it back here to vet first, we can do that, and then, or you can... What would you like to do?
What they did recommend, so right now there's a tree removal permit. A tag gets attached to the actual tree,
mm-hmm.
so that stakeholders can see that visibly. And so it's 7 days for non-specimen trees, and we're recommending 14 for specimens. If you all agree with that,
yeah.
Then I think we can just bring the ordinance back to commission.
Okay.
Okay.
That's fine. You want to make a motion?
So moved. I'll basically just move. Why don't we do this for cleanliness? I'll move the recommendations by staff in the conclusion on page 145.
Perfect. Yep. Do you second that?
Yep.
All right. We're all in favor. Thank you. Moving on to the next item. We're going to take item number 11, which are both Commissioner Alaman and Samuelin's, discussing the proposed locations of historical markers.
Mm-hmm.
And I see Debbie's here.
Good morning, Commissioners. Debbie Tackett with the Planning Department. This referral came to you from the Finance Committee, who reviewed this discussion at their February meeting. At that meeting, the Finance Committee approved a motion to budget $30,000 for current budget year and $30,000 for the next budget year. In addition to that recommendation, the Finance Committee also wanted the administration to take a look at the 24 locations that were proposed by Dr. Long. We did that. We did an analysis of each of those individual sites. We also, in your memo, included kind of a summary of the State of Florida Historical Marker Program, which has certain criteria. It also includes the dimensions, and what I did, just so everyone can get kind of the scale of these markers, is the city currently has one That was installed last year for Barbara Capitan, and that is located at Ocean Drive and 10th Street outside of the Miami Design Preservation League building. So for scale purposes, I wanted to to introduce a photograph. And with my shoes on, I'm approximately 5'6" in that photo. So when we did the analysis of the individual locations, we took that into consideration. And in our opinion, we believe that these are best placed in landscaped areas or areas that are not within the sidewalks. If you're in the sidewalks, you have obstruction issues in terms of the height clearance of these, as well as logistical issues with ripping up the sidewalk to install the foundation. So out of the 24 locations that we reviewed, we believe that locations numbered 1 through 9 would be a great priority. We believe we can find suitable locations for all of those. I can go through them with you, but they're printed in your memo. And we also, in addition to looking at the sites recommended by Dr. Long, kind of looked holistically citywide and came up with our own recommendations. Again, we chose 9 recommendations, and that would be numbers 25 through 33. And we are interested in your feedback or any direction you would like to give us.
Great. Yes, Commissioner.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
In terms of the selection of the locations, I defer to you as our historic preservation officer, and I appreciate that you have selected sites sort of distributed nicely throughout the entire city versus all, you know, in one spot. So I think that's, you're spreading the love, and I appreciate that. As you recall, we had a choice between 1- and 2-sided monument signs.
Correct.
And I think we're budgeting for 2-sided, but you should make the appropriate selection based on placement.
Right.
Administratively, which one makes sense. The 1-sided is a little bit cheaper, so if no one can see the second side, don't bother. I would like to make sure that when we do the placement that they're readable from the sidewalk, that you wouldn't have to, from whatever the walkway is. And I think that is the case with the photo that you've shown, that if somebody was standing on the sidewalk, they would be able to read it. But other than that, I think it looks great.
Yeah, I think it looks great, too. I'm excited that we're moving forward with this. We have so many locations, so I appreciate the thoughtful approach to selecting them, and I'm happy with where we're heading.
Excellent. Thank you.
So, yes, public?
Thank you. excuse me. Kirk Pascal, 7915 Crespi Boulevard. So I was ecstatic with this, and thank you, Commissioner Elliman and Commissioner Samuelin, and of course, to see the North Shore be number one on the list. Just a couple of points I wanted to make. For the North Shore and for Normandy, which are two of only 4 National Register districts we have in Miami Beach, and which were designated in 2009, so that's 10 years ago, and many of us have been advocating for a long time for signage, the idea being that, you know, when you preserve structures, you want to promote them. We want to see a thriving historic districts. And these signs are beautiful. They're really great quality, and I'm grateful for all the work the planning staff have put into it. 2 points I wanted to make, though. While they're, I mean, the quality of them is, you know, the best you could hope for, I guess, for a historic district, for the North Shore and for Normandy in particular, which I hope to promote as broadly and as strongly as possible. I'm concerned about visibility, and these signs, just 2 points I wanted to bring up. First of all, the Collins Avenue. I mean, we have millions of visitors and viewer impressions that go across Collins Avenue that we don't take advantage of. And I'm not sure if that's the right place for a marker like this, but I would strongly plead that we have some sort of signage and not lose out on folks that are either locals or visitors traveling into our city to develop an appreciation for what we have in North Beach. And I could say, having followed this issue for many, many years, that, I mean, I know we've worked on high-quality signs, Alan Shulman and the Terra Group, which haven't yet materialized. Even if we had a reflective road sign, a metal sign, that sort of stated the North Beach Historic District's National Register districts, that would be fantastic. The other point I wanted to make with regard to the placement for the North Shore sign, I'm just a little bit concerned with visibility, that it actually be seen. And, you know, we have the Collins entryway into North Beach. We have the 81st Street pedestrian throughway. And then, obviously, you have the entry into Normandy. And at 80th and Byron, I worry that it won't actually get...
So you're concerned with the location, and
the Normandy one as well.
I
want us to get visibility for those areas. I think they need them. I think it's important that we send a message to the residents and to the property owners that preservation isn't just about protecting buildings, but it's about creating thriving historic districts. And promotion is a huge part of that.
Okay. So,
thank you so much.
Thank you, Kirk.
Thank you.
And our initial impressions for the locations were just a very quick, cursory view of these areas to figure out where they could be placed. It's flexible. One of the things that we look at in terms of placing them on a FDOT right-of-way or close to an intersection is we will be needing to coordinate with other departments, transportation and FDOT, potentially, if it's located off of their right-of-way. So we can explore different locations. We just wanted to make sure that our initial recommendations for locations would not obstruct anything or come into conflict with any potential utilities or sidewalk accessibility issues.
Understood. Anybody have any questions or comments? Commissioner?
I don't have any questions. I support this, and thank you for putting this on, and I think it's wonderful. I just wanted to give an asterisk or a side note to the members of the committee that in reading this, I also reached out to Matt Kenny and city, as his head pops up, and city administration, because while certainly not a historical marker and not nearly as relevant as this, one of the things some cities do and I get questions about is, where do people film things? Where can I go to this famous site that I saw on a TV show or movie? I don't know about the rest of you, but the two that I seem to get the most is Scarface and Birdcage. Like, where were these filmed? So I think that Matt and his department have listed this on the website, and maybe in the future, after we do these more important markers, we may want to consider these additional production areas, which may be of interest.
Markers. Yeah, why not?
Great, okay. Yes,
Just responding to Kirk's discussion about North Shore and Normandy, so, I mean, both of them are placed in park areas where pedestrians are going to be and have an opportunity to interact and read the sign. Is that, that's what you've chosen? I mean, it looks good to me. The Vendome Plaza, where we're creating the new plaza by the fountain, is one location, and the other one is in Tatum Park. So, all right, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, I mean, the only caveat I would say is those areas or whatever is most visible, you know what I mean?
Right,
so
right.
If it's a matter of right now to get a marker in place, and if it does mean working with FDOT or looking at the right-of-way, I don't want it to not be a reality because we have to work with these other agencies. So always keep in mind the most visible.
For a pedestrian.
So I think we should move it with the caveat, all of these locations or most visible in that area. Does that work?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
So moved.
Move it.
Oh, okay.
Oh, that's, now that it's here, I'm not voting.
Okay, now it passes to you two. You got Commissioner Alamon now cannot make the motion.
I'm the alternate.
Oh, Joy. Mark, I'm sorry. I kept thinking you were a member of the committee. I apologize.
Yeah, I can join. For the
Vice Mayor Malikoff is here joining us, as is Commissioner Gongora. So, yes.
Yes, I see.
Okay. By acclamation. Right. It's Monday morning. All right. So now that you're here, Commissioner Gongora, I'm going to start with some of your items.
Sure.
Okay. Let's go with number one, crime in Miami Beach.
Wonderful. Good morning, Major Acosta.
Good morning, Commissioner. Good morning, committee members, Commissioner, city staff. My name is Paul Acosta, the patrol major. Good morning.
think this was put on, and you have some information here, really for those that haven't attended some of the community meetings, to perhaps give us an update on the plans for the upcoming Memorial Day weekend and what we can expect.
Yes, sir. We held two public meetings at our police department over the last couple of weeks, on the 9th and on the 16th, and there wasn't a lot of turnout. The questions that were posed to us were nothing that caught us off guard. We were able to answer them, most of which was pertaining to residential questions, how to get into the green zone and things of that nature. But those meetings went well. As far as moving forward in preparation for this weekend, the only thing that has really changed since the last time we discussed this item was the closing of Española Way. We'll begin that on Thursday evening, the blocking of the roadway from east to west, Collins Avenue to Washington Avenue, with barricades, limit parking, and light up that particular street. What we've noticed with a lot of events that come into that particular area is that that seems to be the hub of a lot of activity. And of course, we had a recent issue here last week or a couple of week and a half ago on that particular street. So what we want to try to do is own the street, have police presence out there, light it up in those dark areas so that when people do congregate, we're able to see things more effectively. We've also instituted some surveillance measures that'll help us also in monitoring that particular street over the four-day weekend.
I don't have a question about Memorial Day because I've been following and reading the LTCs. It's more for the public. I'm throwing out a lot of side notes and asterisk comments today, and I don't expect you to be able to answer this today, but I'd like to take this question back to the police, and maybe you could get back to us via LTC. As everybody knows, because it's all over the news, a commissioner has placed on our agenda for Wednesday an item about authorizing the city manager to have a conversation with Ultra, is how I understand the item. I'd like to know from the police perspective how the police department feels they could handle that or contain that, and whether from a safety perspective, if that's something you would be recommending to us or not.
Okay, Commissioner. I'll make sure I make note of that, and we'll get you an answer.
Thank you. Good answer.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Major. Two things. First, we have in place now an ordinance as it relates to promoters, and I believe there's been some progress on that. But could you just give us a little update as it relates to Memorial Day, these promoted events? It remains a concern in the community. What have we done, accomplished? Where are we on that?
Commissioner, we have, we're monitoring several events. Currently on the radar are about six events at our local clubs. Our intel unit is doing a lot of research, but we're getting into the, getting very detailed in how we communicate with the club promoters, with the people that are going to be performing, their management staff, intelligence on any ongoing problems with regards to any performers coming to our city, and communicating with the police agencies from which those particular issues are arising. So there's a lot of in-the-weeds conversations with promotions, with owners, with promoters, with owners, and with police agencies from particular areas that performers are coming from. And that's what we're doing. So we're monitoring it right now. We feel that we have a pretty good idea of what's coming in, and we're preparing for it. We've increased some staffing around certain areas ahead of Memorial Day weekend, so we'll be ready to go with it.
Good. I like that last part, especially about ready to go with it, so thank you for that.
Sure.
Second thing is the mayor's panel on Ocean Drive and security had a motion where we asked for increased enforcement of quality of life issues and challenges. That was also adopted by the full commission, and I think it's a sense of the community that we want some of these basics, whether it's open container, noise, more aggressively enforced. It's not a Memorial Day question. It's not just spring break. It's year-round. Could you talk about how MBPD has taken that direction, what you've done with it, how it's been operationalized, what the results are? Because this is, I think, an important priority.
Yes, Commissioner. I could tell you at the chief's direction, we've taken a look at how we deploy our resources, in particular and strategies surrounding quality of life issues. You know, with calls for service, we're a busy city, and our police officers are constantly moving all over the city. But we've noticed an increase in these violations of quality of life, so we have to respond to it. So one of the things we've done is we've instituted since we last spoke, since spring break, the overlap detail on day shift, between day shift and afternoon shift, where we have more officers on the street at once. So instead of them just going into service and going to answer calls for service, we're focusing particularly in the areas where the quality of life has been a problem for us. The seawall, as an example, where they're off the limelight of Ocean Drive, but yet they're still in the back end, you know, committing crimes and things of that nature, which impact our residents when they want to go to Muscle Beach, walk up and down or skateboard along seawall, I mean, things of that nature. So the overlap detail, when we're keeping track of our stats as it pertains to arrests, engagements with the community, but more importantly, it's our message. So our message since spring break has been that we have the support of our city staff and our commission, and that we as police officers have to take a more of a stricter approach to enforcing the quality of life issues. And we have so. But the key is the enforcement all year round. We just can't ramp up things surrounding certain special events just because we got a big influx. So consistently, all year round, that's the message. That's my message to my staff here in patrol, uniform police services, and we also work with our CID and undercover folks to support us in that effort. Year round, shift after shift, 24 hours a day, we're gonna, you know, push the pedal down, so to speak, consistently.
Yes.
I don't want to belabor this point today because I don't want to get off track and we have so many items, but I spent a lot of time out this weekend because I have family in town, so I was out in the entertainment district. And we're talking about aggressive enforcement of our laws, but I will tell you a little bit publicly, and I'll tell you more privately, everything that we complain about on the dais is still going on. All of the bad behavior that we complain about as far as the open containers and people smoking marijuana publicly, it was all around me the entire time that I walked up and down on the street. So we're going to have to really start putting our money where our mouth is, so to speak,
sure,
and make a difference, because if I'm seeing it, our residents are seeing it, and for some of them, it makes them not want to go there. It makes them uncomfortable to spend time there, and that's very upsetting to me because I love that area, and I enjoy spending a lot of time visiting there. So we're going to have to really move forward with something that sends a message that we're not accepting that kind of behavior.
Yes, Commissioner, we'll do. Note it.
Yes.
And I guess my last point, and then I'll shut up, is it's my understanding that I believe by our June neighborhoods meeting, we're going to have some direction from the administration as far as whether they're recommending a new police chief or at least an interim police chief. So if, in fact, that happens, and I think it will before our June neighborhoods committee meeting, maybe we could have an update and introduce that person and have them speak here, please.
Yes, Commissioner.
Anybody else? Anything? Thank you for the update. We'll see you, I guess, next month. Okay.
Thank you,
ma'am.
I had a request to take number 24, which is the addendum item regarding the discussion on hospitality employees protections. Of course. On the item that we just had?
About the hospitality.
Oh, yes. First, we're going to present the item, and then we're going to open it up. Absolutely. No, please. All right. So who's presenting?
If I could just state something, because I placed this item on the agenda last time, and I didn't expect it to actually be as controversial as it became, and I understand that there are strong feelings on both sides of the subject, and I just kind of wanted to clarify that I am a supporter and continue to remain a strong supporter of this ordinance regarding the panic devices and safety buttons, and pushed it through neighborhoods and remain a supporter. My concern and the reason that I placed this item on the agenda is, you know, we're always balancing different concerns that we have. And what was told to me was that essentially this was a big expense, especially on smaller businesses, to come up with all at once. So I thought it would be helpful for this body to have a discussion about extending the time for compliance, at least for small businesses. I never chose the one-year extension period. In fact, my original conversations were to the tune of 6 months. But I know there's been a lot of newspaper stories since then and dialogue and conversations. So I think we have an opportunity today, I guess, to figure out what the expense is, what would be an appropriate time to comply, and I guess what actually complies with this ordinance.
Okay. Great. Does anybody want to quickly staff or legal, or should I open it up? Okay, so anybody from the public wish to speak on this matter?
Good morning, everyone. My name is Wendy Kalurgis, and I'm the president and CEO of the Greater Miami and the Beaches Hotel Association. First of all, I want to apologize because I know that we sent you an email last night on Sunday night for the regarding the extension to October 1st. We're very comfortable with that date, but I wanted to also share with you it's almost like a toolkit guide that's been endorsed by the American Hotel Lodging Association. And when you look at and it's all about frequently asked questions for our hotels across the country. The board comprises of a lot of IT directors, you know, from major hotel companies, because there's a lot of questions about the product and what to do. So we have been, our board has endorsed this guide, and I'm going to also email it to you. So I apologize that I made copies this morning. It was not sent last night. So we are very comfortable with an October 1st deadline. In particular, the Marriott hotels are ready to implement the product. Everybody wants to comply. If we can have that extra 90 days, it would be great. And I wanted to introduce Armando Ibarra. He's our UDEI advisory. He's our governmental affairs consultant for local as well as state as well as national.
Thank you. Good morning. I want to thank you all for taking this issue up. We worked very closely with the commission when it was first drafted. I'm very supportive of this ordinance to protect the hotel workers. As Wendy mentioned, our hotels are in the process of implementing this. Many of them are close to finishing. Many of them have already finished in terms of complying with it. And what we ask is just a short extension that will allow some of the hotels that are, you know, approaching that deadline and are close to that deadline so that they have a little bit of a leeway so that they are not out of compliance as they finish their deployment and their testing, et cetera. We want to get this done as soon as possible. We believe it's also a priority for our organization. Our organization takes very seriously the safety and security, not just of visitors, but of employees and residents. In fact, we work with a number of organizations, not just in protecting visitors and employees generally, but also in things like human trafficking, where we have programs to train hotel employees on identifying and dealing with it. And in other areas, we work. We meet monthly with the police department, and a number of other initiatives that we undertake to protect both our visitors and guests. And so, you know, we're very happy to implement this as a protection for our employees. And again, we just ask for a short 90-day extension so that again, especially our smaller hotels can complete their implementation and not come out of compliance. So, thank you again.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to speak on this topic? And then we'll bring it up on the dais.
Committee, commissioners, city staff, Chris Rollins, CEO of South Beach Group Hotels. I also want to state for the record, listen, no one in my organization and all of my fellow colleagues and hoteliers are opposing this ordinance. We support it 100%. We know employee safety is important, and that was never the intention working with anyone in the city to circumvent. We are just asking for a small extension of time to be in compliance, get it right. Commissioner Malakoff was so kind, she sent me a contact. And as we stated, technology changes every day, and it goes down as far as pricing goes every day. You know, we use the example of a flat-screen television at Best Buy. When this ordinance first came out last year, the quotes that were coming in were exorbitant. And since this item hit last week, you would not believe the crazy, for lack of a better term, of vendors coming through, say, we can help you, we can help you. And the community has come through. and said, listen, we can all figure out, we're using each other's connections. So if the committee and the commission sees it, we appreciate the extension. If not, we'll figure it out, because we are here to, keep our employees safe. But thank you for consideration.
Thank you. Anybody else?
Hi, my name is Mike Sheridan, and I'm with Blue Bee Business Services. My company is an independent representative of a safety button called React Mobile. So I have spoken to or attempted to speak to nearly all of the 150 hotels in Miami Beach, and I have some observations that I would like to share. So I'm going to kind of forego some of the statements that I was going to make in regards to the deadline. I think the more optimal way to do it was to leave the deadline in place and then allow hotels on a case-by-case basis to apply for an extension. That being said, I do want to address I would like to address some of the dangerous safety buttons that are currently being adopted in Miami Beach in an effort to save money. The first are buttons that simply emit a noise, and there are major hotels in Miami Beach doing just that. These buttons are small, and they can't emit a sound loud enough to ward off an attacker. They're easily muffled, and they're not loud enough to alert security personnel in a 15-story hotel. So everything today has an alarm, and we've trained ourselves to ignore them. I recently sat on the balcony of my condo listening to an indefinitely blaring alarm. Was it a robbery? Was it a fire? Was it simply an alarm on a mobile phone? Who knows? I just know that everyone ignored it. These types of buttons are as effective as a housekeeper screaming rape. Maybe even less so, at least a screaming person would elicit a response from a passerby than a noise from a noise-emitting alarm. More importantly, deploying a noise-emitting alarm during an attack may actually provoke an attacker. Rob Monkman, the CEO of React Mobile, formed his company after he was a hostage in an armed robbery in college. He says that if he had deployed that kind of a device while the gun was pointed at his head, he would not be alive today. The second type of dangerous solution is one that does not provide location information when the device is activated. Imagine receiving an alert that someone in a 1,400-room hotel is in trouble and not knowing where the person is. Security will have to go floor to floor, door to door, to find the person in distress. It is dangerous because it wastes valuable time when every second counts in an emergency. I spoke with Farot Andeshua in the city attorney's office, who stated that neither of these solutions would fulfill the requirements of the ordinance, as neither solution will summon help to the employee's location. She stated that any formal request for an opinion would need to be made through someone from the city. I've asked Code Compliance to issue a form of guidance to help hotels choose a compliant platform. To my knowledge, this has yet to recur. It was reported in the Miami Herald, who asked the city attorneys for a statement, and they declined as well. I believe it is the job of Code Compliance to work with the city attorney to address and communicate any clarifications that might be required about the city code. The failure to do so has created confusion and has caused some hotels to waste money on a non-compliant solution. I have no doubt that come August 1st, there will be Miami Beach hotels with a dangerous solution in place. Finally, we have all focused on sexual assault and harassment of hotel employees, but these buttons can serve a general public safety purpose. A very big issue that I've heard is that is domestic violence amongst guests. Such incidents occur, if not daily, certainly weekly. These buttons will allow hotel personnel to alert security discreetly in such incidents. These buttons, I'm sorry, wrap up. And they also can be used in terms of medical emergencies. The platform I sold, actually saved someone's life by being able to deploy the button during a heart attack.
Thank you so much. Anybody else wish to speak on this item?
I'd like to ask him a question. Can you, sir?
Yep. Sorry.
The extensions, the way they were explained to us when the referral was made, are being requested because of the implementation time frame required and the cost of the solutions. So in your experience, for a solution that does provide the location of the person pressing the button, what are the range of costs of those solutions?
For the Miami Herald article, I did use a quote that we had provided. It's kind of on the higher end because there's two types of safety buttons that you can that we sell. One pairs with a mobile device, and the other one is standalone that can issue the alert by itself. Obviously, the ones that are standalone are more expensive. So, using the more expensive panic buttons, a 70-room hotel was about $5,500 in upfront cost. And then with 12 panic buttons, which I think is a little high, it was about a $250 monthly recurring cost for the software subscription. The solution that I represent is wireless. It's battery-powered. It requires no cabling, no additional power. So it can be deployed in the matter of days.
Thanks.
Matter of days. Okay. Commissioner?
I think there's somebody else in the public. No? I guess not.
I will say I was contacted by Wendy Walsh from the union. Obviously, they're not in favor of an extension. And because it was added as an addendum, they're running late to get here. So I just wanted to put that out on the record. Commissioner?
Yes. When I saw this, I believe that the safety buttons are great, and I agree that it has to be more than just making a loud sound. It has to tell the location of the hospitality worker in order to make it effective. I was not in favor of postponing it for a year. I think it's just much too long, and I'm definitely in favor of the 90 days. And if you'd like to entertain a motion, I'd be happy to make it.
Any discussion?
Well, just a question, because it's May 20th. The deadline is August the 1st.
Currently, that's the deadline.
So, I mean, if it's 90 days from today, I mean,
well, it's October 1st is what...
Right. No, I know. I'm proposing that it should be shorter than that in order to reduce the window
right.
that the housekeepers are going to be unprotected.
Right.
You know, if what we're talking about is, because there was already, with this ordinance when we passed it, a year to comply. So folks have had time. I think that I understand the trade-off that a hotelier would have to make, knowing that they've got a year to make a decision and technology does change rapidly. They might, you know, be in a posture to delay that decision to get the best value proposition, right? The best solution for the cheapest money. Who wouldn't do that? But at this point, if we know that there's solutions that are economical and can be implemented very briefly, I'd rather see us look at 90 days from today versus 90 days from a deadline that is
more
than 2 months
away. It's 60 days. 60 days from the deadline. Instead of August, it's October. I think that's 60 days, not 90 days.
Okay. So that would be until October 1st?
August, September, October 1st.
Sure.
It's only the month of August and the month of September. And by October 1st, it has to be in place. So
I think
it's really
that's fair.
60
I'll
days,
second,
although
I'll second
90.
That.
Commissioner Samuelin? No? Okay, well, I don't know how I feel about an extension altogether. So you wanted to have it October 1st
yes.
be in?
It's actually 60 days from the deadline, which now is August 1st.
So we're now, how many months left, how many days from today to the actual August deadline? Was it August 1st they had to be compliant with? Mm-hmm. By?
I think so.
August 1st is the deadline, so you're looking at approximately 71 days
from today. And you said that you would be more comfortable with 90 from today. Yeah, I mean, the most I think I would be comfortable with, and I think we could comply if we just do 30 days, like by September instead of October 1st.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, so what you're proposing is a 30-day extension from the current deadline till September 1st.
Correct.
What I want to do
is I
don't want this to pass on a 2-1. I want to do something that this body is going to collectively support at the commission so we're not back there, you know, figuring it out again.
Right.
Does everybody on this body feel comfortable with a 30-day extension until September 1st?
I can support.
That 30, I think I can wrap my arms around. Beyond that, I don't think I can because there has been a year, and I know the hotels have been actually working really hard towards making this happen. As a matter of fact, they came to us not in July. They came to us now so that we can try to figure this out together. So I appreciate everybody that came
today,
the early warning that we could be having some implementation issues. How are you going to determine whether or not a hotel has been in compliant on that date? What is the methodology that we're going to be using?
They're required to submit an affidavit with their business tax receipt confirming compliance with the ordinance.
Okay. Yeah.
That would be effective. They would be submitting that for October 1. And I believe the impetus behind having it on August 1st was to make sure that everything was up and running, so when they do submit it, their new BTRs, they would have that affidavit. So that was kind of, the reasoning why was several months before the October 1 deadline.
Right.
Just food for thought.
Madam Chair,
yes.
The reason that I'm really asking for the 60 days from August 1st is because, I certainly want housekeepers to be protected as soon as possible. We had one representative from one company saying it's so simple, it's reasonable, et cetera. That's a gentleman who has something to sell. I believe that there are many small hotels that have to comply, that it's not as easy for them financially. And they have a summer coming up. I believe October 1st is a fair date to give them. I really do. It's not that much longer.
Someone from staff, Eric, was looking into this because, Commissioner Malikoff is right to be concerned about, putting all of our confidence in a single vendor that's presenting and is in a sales mode. But I do believe that, perhaps ACM Taxes that was vetting, there were a number of, I must have gotten four emails from technology vendors who all had solutions that seemed very economical and very easy to implement. And I was routing those all to the administration so that the administration could reflect as a third-party, independent, non-biased observer whether there were technology solutions out there that could be implemented very easily and quickly. Because, look, if there aren't, I want to be sensitive to the businesses. It's a technology investment. But if there are off-the-shelf, vanilla, wireless, cell phone-enabled packages that can protect someone's personal safety and be implemented in a matter of days, then I'm not sure what we're doing here. And I want to feel really confident when this comes back to the commission
to vote
on that I'm making an informed vote.
And that's correct. It was a combination of our IT department and our human resources department that were teaming up to look into technology. Obviously, the ordinance is technology non-specific, purposefully, but they were trying to find out, what is the gamut of options that are out there, and obviously there are going to be some more expensive and some that are less expensive.
When does this come back for first read once it passes neighborhoods?
I believe we were trying to get two hearings in before the August 1st deadline.
Right.
So
that's why it was put on this agenda as a supplement.
Yeah.
June and July.
Can I ask?
I'd be fine with 30, and then if
that's
the administration comes back and
that's
they're like, the very best solutions require hardware and, a new network and new wiring, then we might say, 30 might not be enough.
That's where I was at.
I just want to reach some type of agreement here. Mm-hmm. I think Commissioner Malikoff has been recommending 60 days. You've indicated that you feel more comfortable with 30 days. Like I said, I just want to avoid controversy about if we split the baby. We do a 45-day extension until September 15th, and we sing Kumbaya, and hopefully everybody will be happy and be able to get this done.
Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
I support that sort of middle ground here. Probably the most important thing we can do, given there are five of us sitting here, is make a decision and give certainty to the community. I've heard the 60 days, 30 days. Now we're talking about a couple weeks difference. So I think given the information we have today, 45 days does sound reasonable, and at least if the five of us could sort of get on board with that, then the community knows the answer. If we start moving the goalpost as they get, that to me is a worse outcome. So I would be supportive of the 45.
Yes, Commissioner?
I just want to be straightforward with you all, since we don't have, because I've been in these situations before at committee where someone tries to secure a vote at the commission level here at committee. And since we haven't been informed by staff as to their analysis, I'm going to reserve my commitment right. until I receive that analysis.
Okay.
Yeah, and I feel, look, I would prefer no extension, right? If I had my choice, I don't think we should have an extension. But for purposes of moving it out of committee and to the commission, your suggestion is 45. You know, I guess 30 to 45, I mean, the 15 days isn't a big deal. Except for that, I think this is something that did require a full year. Already was given enough time to try to calculate for that. So my vote may change on the dais, pending what analysis comes back, pending where we are in the process. And, of course, when those members from Unite here come, I'll give them a few minutes to speak, even if we've ended this item. So before I wrap it up, anybody else have any thoughts or...
No. Do you feel comfortable amending the motion to 45 days, Commissioner Malikov?
You go make the motion.
Okay. I'll second.
I'm not, I do think 2 months from August 1st is fair.
I do too, but I'm just trying to make sure what we think can pass commission. So I'll second the motion for 45 days.
Okay. So by acclamation.
I didn't make the motion.
She didn't make the motion. Michael Gongora made the motion. We're going to do it by acclamation at this time. And, of course, it's subject to change at the commission, but it gives you an idea of where all our heads are at. You know, we'll see where it goes from here. And with that, we will move on to the next item. Item number 3. Pilot program for docked electric-assisted bicycles.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. Jose Gonzalez, Transportation Director. The last time that we were before you with this item was on November 30th, where we discussed one vendor in particular, Ride-On, who the county engaged to provide electric-assisted bicycle sharing services throughout Miami-Dade County. And so Ride-On approached us with a desire to come into our city and provide these services. They stated that the contract that they have with the county allows them to deploy these bicycles on county-owned facilities and county-owned right-of-way. So that triggered, in essence, this item and some discussions. At the November 30th meeting, this body asked us to research the issue a bit further to see if it, you know, would be possible to, if there was an appetite, to deploy a pilot program with a docked electric-assisted bicycle vendor. Ride-On is a vendor that provides that type of service. And we were asked to also research, you know, that contract, research the code. And this was also a topic of conversation at the last legislative session in Tallahassee. So since then, we've done some research. We've worked with both our procurement department as well as with the city attorney's office, and with regard to the use of, because there was a concern with the use of these bikes, whether or not they can use bike lanes, on street bike lanes. So our city attorney's office has opined that as long as the bicycle meets the definition that's set forth in Florida statutes and in our city code, which requires the bicycle to be pedal assisted, it could have a combination of both functions, pedal assist as well as power assist, but it could not be fully electric. If it meets that definition, then it can legally be operated on street bike lanes and on travel lanes. Worked with procurement to try to explore different ways of engaging a company to provide these services. We looked at three options. Those are laid out in the memo before you. The first option is to waive competitive bidding requirements and procure a pilot with Ride-On. The second option was to amend the city's contract with Citibike, which would not require a bid waiver, and the city's current contract with Citibike does provide for additional services, and this would provision of electric bike, electric assist bikes would qualify as an additional service. And the third option is to issue a competitive solicitation for a new procurement of docked electric assisted bicycle sharing pilot program. Upon reviewing the three options, the administration believes that the one that's in our best interest is the second option, which is that of exercising the provision in the City Bike, in the current contract with City Bike, to provide these services on a pilot basis. We're recommending this option for a couple reasons. First, it's the quickest way to engage a vendor on a pilot basis, given that there's already an available contract. And by the way, I did not mention that the current contract with Ride-On was determined to not be available for a piggyback. So we would not be able to use the county's current contract with Ride-On for these services. And so the second reason we believe that it's in the city's best interest to amend the contract with City Bike is because it would essentially reduce or eliminate the need for additional infrastructure on our sidewalks and eliminate the need to eliminate on-street parking spaces. Any other vendor would likely need to add infrastructure on either our sidewalks or on-street parking spaces.
Okay, thank you. Everybody get that? All right.
Got it.
Commissioners.
Any implementation that goes after additional right-of-way, additional parking spaces or other space, I'm opposed to. I don't think that this technology is bringing enough value, incremental new value to the city to offset, you know, that loss of parking and public right-of-way. So for me, any options that have that, I would just take it off the table, personally. I'm not opposed to piloting with City Bike for a brief time period if that allows us to pilot more quickly and has it's less staff intensive and so forth. But I would certainly not see that as any type of advantage for a long-term bid. It would need to be a competitive bid.
Okay, I guess the first question we have to figure out is if we're a go or no go, right? Do we want to see this or not as a body? And then past that point, if there is a will to even explore this, then the methodology or the avenue to get there. But so I guess first what I'll do is I'll open it up. Everybody will get their couple minutes to speak on this item, and then we'll bring it up here and figure out the course. Yes.
Good morning, Javier Corioso, Uber Technologies. And many of you may be asking yourselves, why is Uber here, since we're primarily known as a ride-sharing company? And if you look to your right, you see our Jump electric pedal assist bicycle. And over the last year or so, we've really worked to turn our app and our platform into a multimodal transportation platform, which includes the ride-sharing options that everyone's familiar with, as well as e-bikes and, in some markets, public transit as well. There are over 15 million people that use our app daily to get from point A to point B. And in 15 cities throughout the world, including Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Paris, and as of last week, Berlin, Uber users not only use ride-sharing products, but they use electric pedal assist bikes to get around, especially during commute times. The very unique feature of this bike is that it has a lock. So you have to lock it to infrastructure, which deals with a lot of the nuisances that you've seen in some cities with a few of the bike share providers that have come onto the market, and you've seen bikes left on right-of-ways, front lawns, et cetera. We deal with this issue with requiring our users to lock this to a bike rack or other bike infrastructure. That's very important because Miami Beach has really invested a lot in bike infrastructure. You're at the forefront here in South Florida of being a welcoming city to bike users. And it's a market that's definitely not only attractive to us, but I think would be very successful for the city. Bike sharing is also an industry that's seen a lot of innovations and a lot of new technologies since the city embarked on its partnership with its current bike share provider, which, by the way, your city attorney has opined that it's not an exclusive agreement. So what we'd like to see is an opportunity to expand the bike share options available to the residents and visitors of Miami Beach, bring competition into the market. This legislature, just like Mr. Gonzalez mentioned, passed a bill. It's awaiting the governor's signature, hopefully, that really gives cities the opportunity to either pilot or procure micro-mobility programs. So we really appreciate the opportunity and would really suggest that this is opened up to a pilot that brings competition and, okay. and leaders in the industry into the space. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. Mickey Moreau here on behalf of Citibike. As you all know, the Citibike has been the bike share provider for the city for almost 10 years now, currently has a contract for another 5 years with the city. And I will tell you that, you know, really to your benefit and thank you to you all, Citibike in Miami Beach is one of the most successful bike share programs in the country. It is a program that came in and has been growing steadily over the years. Our busiest month was last month. That just goes to show you that it's been growing, usership has gone up, and we continue to have a great relationship with the city that includes profit sharing and includes just increased ridership, increased enjoyment. With regard to electric assist bikes, we were here back in November, as Mr. Gonzalez mentioned, and the request from you all was, could you, being Citibike, find a way to work with Ride-On, since they have the county contract, to work together to come back with a product? And I will tell you that we certainly tried. My client flew to Spain on two occasions to meet with their principals. It was a really valiant, good faith effort to make that happen. Unfortunately, I'm not getting into business details, but there was some issues with that relationship, and there was a change in personnel, and we weren't able to do it. And they're not here today, unfortunately, and well, I don't know if they'll be back. But the bottom line is we, on our own, have the infrastructure in place. We have the infrastructure in place today. Solely, if you all want a electric bike program, and I don't know that you do, but if you do, we are ready to integrate it into our existing infrastructure today. Would not require one additional inch of city parking to be removed. Would not require any more infrastructure unless you wanted us to add stations. But the stations that we have there today are fully convertible to integrate electric bikes, and we'd be happy to do that. So if you all choose to go forward with a pilot, Citibike has language in its contract that allows additional technologies to be incorporated, and we are ready to go as soon as you give us a green light. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to speak on this item?
Can I ask a question of Jose?
I'll bring it back up to the dais. Jose?
Jose, so when I read the item, it talked about docked. And so I was picturing in my mind, you know, same thing what we have with Citibike, which is where, you know, they're strategically located, common docked spaces. But when I heard the presentation from this vendor, when they say docked, where it can be docked is sounds like it's much more fluid because it could be any bike rack or other, you know, appropriate place, which
my understanding
is. So I take back my earlier comment about no incremental value add, because I've always seen it with our city bike solution as there's always going to be a group of people that it doesn't work for, because you have to pick it up and return it from a predetermined location. It's not a true origin to destination solution. It could be a close by, and I believe probably that most of the riders today probably either live or work very close to one of the pre-existing stations. But it doesn't really help someone, particularly like I'm wearing high heels today, I'm not going to walk six blocks to get to a Citibike. I'm just going to get in an Uber, right? So if this type of technology actually is can be located more flexibly, I would be open-minded to a pilot.
In your heels?
In my heel. I could ride that one. I just checked it out.
Yes, Commissioner Malakoff.
There have been problems with electric bikes in other cities where they have been used, specifically with braking problems where riders have been thrown over the handlebars and hurt. I don't know that it's a proven technology that we want to introduce to our city, number one. Number two, if we introduce it at all, I would recommend that we do it with City Bike, and I would not like to see other electric bicycles parked throughout the city. I've been in other cities, but specifically in California, where they're just left, they have a geofencing and they're left in open spaces, et cetera. I don't think we want that in our city. It's too dense here.
Commissioner?
Yeah, I agree with the comments of my colleagues. We're just such a dense city. You know, the cities that have these kind of freestanding bikes, you see them in California, D.C., but they're kind of, they have more space for it. We don't. We're trying to free up space so that we have more mobility throughout our city. So I'm not really in favor of freestanding, and I'm also in agreement with Commissioner Alleman's comments that we're not going to do anything that takes away more parking, which is at a shortage. So I feel if we're going to do this, the best fit is the city recommendation to move forward with our partner at City Bike, because they can incorporate them into the already existing bike stands that they have. I don't have a strong preference for electric bikes or against electric bikes. I do know that a lot of younger people like them because they provide more mobility, and Commissioner Alleman can ride them in her heels, and I can ride them in my boots. if we are going to move forward, I would say with City Bike, but for me it would be a small pilot project of maybe 10 to 20 bikes max in strategic locations to see if they work, and I would be open to something like that.
Commissioner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a first question picking up on Commissioner Malikoff. Jose, what can you share about safety? What do we know from other cities? Are there more accidents with electric bikes than regular? Are there more severe? Do you have that, or could that be a follow-up just to educate us on safety a bit more?
I could certainly read a little more into that, but my understanding is that it occurred in New York City, and it was a particular vendor where there were issues with the braking, and it was even if the user would not brake very hard, the electric bicycle would, and the user would then, you know, somersault over the bike. I did read about that. It occurred in New York, but I don't know if it was an isolated case. I do know that it was one particular vendor, and they were looking into it. They pulled all their bikes out of the public right-of-way, and they were looking into that safety concern before putting them back out.
I would like to hear a little bit more as we proceed about the safety track record, just so we get comfortable around that. I have been advocating for us to take a measured approach to these new technologies. Just Sunday, I almost tripped over a scooter sitting in the sidewalk. And I figured, you know, by the time I walked backwards, it would go away, and it didn't go away. So I think by now it should have gone away. So I've been wanting to go slow. So the idea of a more confined, docked program does lead me to support the administration's recommendation with City Bike, where we know where it's going. We're going to put a few out there, pending the safety, and we're going to see what happens. So that's sort of my leaning at this point.
So I just want to make sure I understand. Is it that you're in favor of exploring it, and then if we are exploring it, to go the route of the staff recommendation, or are you not necessarily in favor of exploring it, but if the will was to explore? I'm trying to understand where
everybody that's going. I appreciate that. No, I support a pilot. I want to see the safety data and get comfort that this is not a safety concern, and that if there are safety issues, that we manage it. But I do support a pilot, and I would support it with City Bike. And my logic there is we're going to go slow anyway. We have the infrastructure in place, and then that's the way to do this with existing infrastructure and also limited efforts, you know, without having to go through the whole process. So.
And Michael?
I feel the same. I'm open to exploring a small pilot with City Bike. I'd like to know what it would look like before I give it a final approval, but in concept, I support that.
Commissioner? Jose?
Yes.
So I think there's, to me, there's two conversations that we're having. One is clutter. And this came up a lot when we were being presented an approach by a number of the electric assisted scooter companies. those which are completely dockless and can truly be left anywhere. And our main concern, I think, was clutter and safety associated with having something left in the right of way. As far as these electrical assist bikes, I think we need to explore who are we trying to get at. Are we just interested in cannibalizing another bike ride? So I would have gotten on a pedal bike, and this is an alternative for someone who wants to be on a bike, and they can either choose a pedal bike or they can choose an electrical assist. And maybe we pick up some additional ridership. I'm not sure who you might pick up some additional folks. What interests me more is, can an electrical assist bike convert a ride share, which is a car, into something like that? Because then we're taking cars off the road, and that I can get excited about. So how can we learn whether an electrical assist bike with a bike that doesn't have to go back to a particular station but does have to be tethered to a bike rack? So it's in a, it, you know, if it has to be tethered to a bike rack, then it's home, so to speak. It's in a good place that we're okay with because we put a bike rack there. How can I know that if we're going to pilot any of these, whether it's City Bike or this or something else, what modes we're converting from? Am I converting from cars, rideshare, or am I converting from pedal bikes? That I would want to know. And honestly, I think that's the point of the pilot, too, isn't it? Because how would I decide whether I want more of these things or I don't unless I know what modes I'm converting from?
Right. I think it would be important to survey the users. We could certainly do that during any pilot. I would presume any pilot would be at least 6 months in duration. During that time, we can prepare some surveys and survey users to see, you know, were they using their car initially and now they're using this mode, or were they just using a conventional bike and now they're using an electric assist bike?
Are there any transportation industry independent third party organizations that have studied that in other markets? Is there any research that's not a sales collateral thing? That's
we can look into that to see what research is out there, either the Transportation Research Board, for example, or an organization like that that has.
Yeah. Yes, Eric.
I would make the assumption that for recreational users, there's probably a cutoff point where you would go from a bicycle to an automobile ride. So we could potentially set up, as part of the pilot study, an origin destination survey that will see how long people are riding these electric assist bikes, and then that would dictate probably a good understanding of whether or not we're really getting at some of the riders that would have otherwise taken a car.
It's interesting. You brought up an interesting point. Who's that end user? Is it the resident? Is it the visitor? You know, who is that end user? And that data would be interesting. So for me, just so everybody knows, you know, I am more hesitant about moving forward with any sort of pilot without understanding a little bit more. It's not just the safety concerns of the bikes themselves, but also where they're allowed to be. On the sidewalk, because they have pedals, or on the bike lane. And then what does that do to current...
That's in the state legislature, I believe.
Correct. So right now that's there. Then, of course, some of the municipalities that have started pulling back on these electric-assisted bicycles, you know, due to whatever reason. And I think I need a little bit more information to get comfortable personally. So if there's a will to explore, maybe what we could do this, bring it to the next neighborhoods meeting, give us your vision of how this would be. This is conceptual. Show me, tell me what it is, the vision is, how many bicycles we'd be piloting, all the data necessary, any outside research that Commissioner Aleman requested for, if we could find, if any exists, so that we can make a more informed decision. I would be more comfortable with that. I don't know how my colleagues feel.
It's fine with me. I mean, this isn't an emergency decide today.
Madam Chair.
Who knows? I may change my, you know, perspective on this, but for now, yeah.
Madam Chair, I would support that as well. I'm not a voting member, but one additional ask would be the financial impact. Does it, what, How does this impact our financials with City Bike? What would that look like? I think that should be part of the mix.
All right, so it's not a motion, it's direction. And if June is not enough time, let us know, because we want to do this right if we do it. So let us know if it's June or July, okay?
Okay.
Thank you, Jose. Jean Olin is here, and I don't want to make her wait any longer. I know she has to go, so we're going to take up item number 12 really quickly. And thank you, everybody, for coming and speaking on this item today. Very interesting, actually. Could be the wave of the future.
Good morning, everybody.
Okay, just briefly, this, just so everybody's aware, this is the discussion about potentially adding a ballot question to just clean up our charter amendment regarding the filling of a vacancy, because I think the commission should have that flexibility and should be determined ahead of time. The state has a resigned to run law for a reason, and I think part of that is also to allow municipalities to be able, upon that submission of your irrevocable letter of resignation, the cities at that point should be able to have that discussion. We shouldn't have to wait till a vacancy is then occurred, in my opinion, to then have that discussion of appointment or giving a small finite amount of time or costing such an expensive election to fill that vacancy, or making candidates and people wait that much longer to know whether or not they'd be filling that appointment. So there are a lot of reasons, I think, and it gives the commission more flexibility. Take it away.
Right.
That about does it. Everything Commissioner Steinberg has explained is what the effect will be if this proposed measure is placed on the ballot and if the voters approve it. And the commissioner referenced the state resigned to run law. You know, as you know, there is a state law that talks about if a incumbent member of the city commission wishes to run for another office whose term overlaps with the term that the commissioner presently has, then that individual is required to file a resignation, and the resignation has to be filed no later than 10 days prior to the first day of qualifying for the office for which that person seeks the other office. The problem that has occurred in Miami Beach with your existing charter is that right now the charter section says that upon a vacancy occurring, and that's the key, upon a vacancy occurring, the City Commission shall consider whether to appoint to fill the vacancy or to hold an election. Well, under the strict reading of the charter, the vacancy occurs once the person actually leaves. There has been interpretation by the city attorney's office in the past, and as recently as 2006 with Commissioner Gongora's election.
Yes, it's true. It was my first election.
And prior to that, 1997, the City Commission has followed the advice of the City Attorney's Office, saying that even though the existing charter talks about the timing of the appointment, the Commission is permitted to, prior to the actual vacancy occurring, discuss the issue of whether or not to have an appointment or an election. And in light of certain case law, namely Florida Supreme Court case law, which we've always felt would support the city's right to have an election earlier than the actual vacancy in order to coincide that election with a regularly scheduled city or countywide election. And the value of that is, as Commissioner Steinberg has pointed out, a saving of funds. As your city clerk has told you, I believe, when this issue came up during the discussion that you had last year concerning the Group 4 vacancy, when the city of Miami Beach has a standalone election, it is approximately, I think, in the neighborhood of $330,000 for the general and $330,000 for the runoff if you need to have a runoff. If, however, the city amends 2.07, to be able to piggyback onto a regularly scheduled county or city election prior to the actual vacancy occurring, the cost of the election to fill that vacancy, if the commission chose not to appoint but rather to have the election, would be in the neighborhood of, I think it's around $35,000 as opposed to $350,000. keeping in mind, though, you may still have to pay the $300,000 figure if a runoff is necessary. But obviously, there are savings to be achieved. And the final benefit of doing this amendment and the voters approving it is that, as Commissioner Steinberg has pointed out, by having the election, again, if the commission chooses not to fill the vacancy by appointment, by having the vacancy filled by election prior to the actual vacancy occurring, it will actually lessen the amount of time by which that vacancy actually exists. Because you know what I mean. If you have to wait until the actual vacancy exists, then under the charter, the commission has 30 days to discuss whether or not to appoint. And at the end of that 30-day period, if they decide not to appoint, then to call an election, which will occur months later, all the while you have that open vacant seat, as opposed to if the charter is amended to allow for the discussion of how to fill the vacancy, whether by appointment or election. And if the commission says, you know what, we're not going to fill it by appointment, we're going to have an election, the commission can then schedule that election for the city or countywide election intervening the period from the filing date of the resignation to the actual vacancy. And the effect of that will be, by the time the actual vacancy occurs, the person will have already been selected to fill the vacancy and can be sworn in the day following the effective date of that resignation. So for all of those reasons, there is a value to having this charter amendment considered by the electorate, and it certainly is within your power and the City Commission's power as a matter of home rule for you to do this charter amendment, and that is what is before you.
Thank you, Jean. Yeah, and this is something that actually came up years ago that I first brought up back in 2013 and 14 and 15. As a matter of fact, we were discussing this, and then it got tabled. But so I thought now is a great time to have that discussion. And also, right now, the way the charter reads, whatever city attorney is sitting in the city attorney's office will have their own interpretation. So this clarifies it and cleans it up because, you know, Murray Dubin had one interpretation, Jose Smith had one interpretation, our current city attorney has their interpretation, and they're all correct, right? Under the charter, they're all correct, but it's a way to clarify. Commissioner?
Yeah, no, I appreciate you putting this on, and thank you, Jean, for that very thorough explanation, and nice to see you. Welcome back to City Hall. But yes, actually in 2006, when I won in a special election, there was a different interpretation than we have currently because the code hasn't changed. But in 2006, they authorized me to run in November, even though the vacancy technically didn't exist until November when Louis Garcia left to run for the state. And then I think it's when the former Commissioner Steinberg left to run for the state, it was pointed out that a different, perhaps more technical reading would require the vacancy to actually occur. And that's first. And that's what we've been following now with Commissioner Rosen Gonzalez when she left and the appointment of Commissioner Malikoff. I generally am in favor of elections over appointments. I think probably everybody is because we're not exerting our preference for any particular person or candidate. The will of the public is selecting their elected official. But the argument that's existed and why we've started appointing is because this technical reading then would require us to potentially spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on a special election, and then the financial impact comes in. So I love this, and as I understand it, how for people in the public, to give a real-life example, you know, when Commissioner Rosen Gonzalez announced her resignation, we could have piggybacked her election in November. Somebody could have won.
Or appointed back then.
Or appointed back then.
And we still can, right, with this appointment and go on.
Yeah, they could do either, but we could have piggybacked it on the general election, and then they wouldn't take office until the day she actually left, whatever it was in January. So this would allow that flexibility.
Right.
Correct?
Yes.
Well, again, I just want to make clear, there is a legal opinion that prior city commissions have followed, and that legal opinion still exists. Mm-hmm. City Attorney Aguila, his opinion was to follow a strict reading for purposes of the situation dealing with Group 4 Commissioner Rosen Gonzalez. And that is a strict interpretation. That's a correct strict interpretation. But there are interpretations. I just want to emphasize that there is legality to both interpretations.
Right. And this would
yes, what this will do is that this will negate the need for any future city attorney to decide, do I want to follow a strict interpretation or do I want to go with an interpretation that we believe is defensible but may be subject to challenge.
I like it. I move it.
I second it.
All right.
Hi, Jean.
By acclamation. Thank you, Jean.
Thank you.
All right, moving on to item number. I know we have people here from the GMCVB and others. If you all will indulge me, I'm going to take item number 6. Just so everybody understands why I put this item on the agenda, with the new convention center up and running, and even with the hotel now that's going to be online, you know, kind of understanding what we're doing as a city to focus on this hotel. A lot of, on the convention center, a lot of time, energy, and so forth has been spent on our convention center, and hopefully it has that return on investment, right? And what role is it that Miami Beach is doing versus GMCBB versus Spectra and everybody involved? I mean, we're all in this together, and we all want to see it being marketed in the right, best way. And so it was a great way to kind of introduce what we are doing, right? Remind everybody out there, this is what's happening. This is what we're doing. This is what the vision is moving forward. And if anybody has any questions or comments, we can take that. But please.
Yeah, so basically... Matt Kenny, Director of Tourism and Culture. Basically, as Commissioner Steinberg said, we had all the entities come together and do a presentation to the Convention Center Advisory Board. They included the GMCBB, Spectra, and we have our internal marketing communications team as well. And basically, what happened was GMCBB presented their plan, which speaks mostly to P1 and P2, which is our larger events, international events. And then we have Spectra that's handling the marketing and communications for the P3 and social catering business. And then our team, Tanya's team in marketing communications, kind of takes their information, further disperses it out, but also kind of is the go-between for our residents, telling them what all the other entities are doing. So presented to the CCAB, no one seemed to have any questions. There was some great feedback on, you know, ways to... move it forward and make it a little bit better, but overall I think the marketing plans from everyone were well aligned. I think everybody's working well together and in constant communication, which I think is also key for this to make sure. And I think what's also interesting to note too is we are trying to promote the convention center kind of as a cultural campus. So it's the convention center, but it's also the botanical gardens, it's the New World Symphony, it's the Fillmore, and we have all these great entities in the same block. And so all of them are kind of talking now to help cross-promote and cross-market what's going on, because we're getting a lot of conventions coming in asking, what else do you have other than your building? When we're done with our convention, what else can you do? And some of them are actually asking us to put together programs for them for the evenings.
Just to understand, are those convention goers that have already booked and are here asking what else to do, or are they looking to know what else to do before they book?
Both. So we were in a meeting with one of them where one of the ways they were going to decide where to go was, what else can you offer us? Can you offer us guided tours? What else do you have going on in the city? And then some of them, once they've booked, have said, you know, what's going on in the park across the street? Can we activate something there? Can we get our attendees outside of the building? So we're running into both, and we're kind of working those into our marketing plans moving forward as well, realizing that it's no longer in 2019 just about marketing that building. It's marketing kind of the whole experience of when they come to Miami and Miami Beach. We need to show them why we differ from other cities. And,
right. You
know, we have a lot more to offer, I think.
Definitely.
On the record.
Yes.
Or better.
Anybody else would like to speak? No? Maybe? Anybody?
They're my support group.
Any questions or comments?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. First off, thank you for the great team effort. It looks like we've got some really good plans coming into place. I have three just sort of thoughts. You can respond on the cuff or maybe just food for thought. One is, how do our goals and occupancy compare with other cities? Two, what is the sort of tracking and reporting progress in terms of how we're doing? I saw the goals. Mm-hmm. How do we know? When will we hear more about it? And three, one thing I didn't see that I think would be helpful, is there some way to take some of the associated cost and overlay so we see what is the net return to the city so that we get sort of like a P&L view? Mm-hmm. So those are three sort of observations. I'd love to hear your thoughts now or as you continue the process.
Yeah, so I think the P&L thing is interesting, and I think that's definitely something moving forward we've all kind of been talking about. Is one of the things, I mean, full transparency we're running into right now is not having a CO on the building has kind of shifted, mm-hmm. you know, are we hitting our goals? I think, you know, the teams from the GMCVB and Spectra have done incredibly well given the challenges that, you know, have been presented with the delays. But I think part of what our conversation is in the next couple months, July, I think we're going to be having our goal setting for the next year. And part of that is definitely going to be now that we have a building or will have a building, making sure that we have ways in which to track exactly not only attendance, but how it's affecting hotels, what's the spend, you know, in the GMCVB even going forward to pull this business in. So I think it's all in the head right now and it's all the plan just until we get that building 100% ours. It's limiting us a little bit in terms of exceeding our goals, let's say.
Wait, I'm sorry. What did you mean? What did you?
Just not having the building right now because it's still under construction technically. That
before we get the final CO,
right? And before we get the final CO, and not really knowing what that full optimum procedure is of the building because we haven't been able. Every time we hold a convention there, they have to move in every piece of furniture and then move it back out. So there's a lot of things happening that won't be happening in the future and will make this a much more well-oiled machine in terms of tracking costs and time and how quickly it takes to turn over a show. Mm-hmm. That sort of, those
got
will
it.
All
but, kind
of,
okay.
The
but
wrinkles.
The promotions are ongoing.
100%. Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're booking, I believe, 2029 right now, I saw.
Yeah, Rolando,
something
come
coming
on.
In. So we had a show for 2029 trying to book.
Yeah.
2029.
How are you hiding?
Well, I always want to be deferential to our city partners, but I can speak about the goal-setting process. And good morning, Rolando Eder with the Greater Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau, Madam Chair, Commissioners. You asked about the goals and the mechanisms and the reporting structure, and I think that's, you know, we're in year four of our current agreement, and we achieved all the goals that were set for years one through three. Now, these are not goals that we're setting, nor candidly the city. Every time about this time of the year, the industry gets together. You have all the major hoteliers, including the major Miami Beach hotel partners, the Marriotts of the world. We get into a room not too far from here, and we establish the goals of the meetings and conventions, the P1s and P2s that we want to book, and, of course, our close partners at Spectra on the P3 and social media, which is critically important as well. So those goals are then captured in a monthly dashboard, and that monthly dashboard, which speaks to percentage of achieving the goal, is shared with our city partners, and perhaps that's an opportunity to share it with you as well. So there's a very, very formal goal-setting process, and also there's a gentleman, Dan Fenton, who is the city's consultant, has played an integral role in setting those goals. And it's just not goals on bookings, it's goals on activity, because ultimately activity drives bookings, there's leads. And the other thing that's been interwoven into our relationship with the city are food and beverage goals at the MBCC. While that may not be our primary goal, I think it's a critical way that we're working closer than ever with our partners at Spectra, because ultimately it's about the profitability and the P&L for the facility as a whole. So I will say that the intimacy of our sales and marketing relationship is greater than ever. And I will add one thing that Matt mentioned from the CCAB meeting. I think there's a good opportunity to use some of the activities that we're doing, the GMCVB and Spectra, and share it more so with your internal communications team to make sure that the city residents are as aware of what's going on and how their building is being marketed and how they can engage more so. And I thought that was one of the key takeaways because, you know, we're doing videos and social media postings and materials, and we're so hyper-focused on the customers that are sitting around the world or around the country. But you have some key constituents locally, and I think some of those same assets can help on that communications front as well with Tanya and her team.
And that's definitely something we were talking about in terms of the little small piece that's missing right now is how much do we promote a building that the residents can't technically access yet without that CO. So that's the piece that we're fully planning for, and we're putting out the kind of little leaked messages. But then once we have CO, we'll be a full not only marketing plan, but the idea too of how to get some residents in that building, see it, and you know, believe in what that building was built for.
And I did want to add, just Friday was a perfect example of the close collaboration with Spectra and the city, because quite often, you know, you have multiple entities working on behalf of the city filling this convention center. And while we take the lead with P1 and P2 and Spectra's P3, you know, in your package, you'll see a matrix that clearly outlines the roles, the responsibilities, so that it's all done very efficiently. And then on Friday, you know, we were going back and forth on Friday to close a really, really important piece of business, TCT. It's a cardiovascular thoracic surgeon convention that is going to be coming to your convention center in 2020 and hopefully repeatedly. But it took some close choreography on the language in the agreement, because there are some nuances with current construction and the headquarter hotel, which is an amazing, amazing thing, but the city rightfully so has to insert some language to protect itself about, you know, some of the potential disruptions that headquarter hotel, which we frankly don't foresee any. But there is, you know, there is always attorneys involved. But I want to give a lot of credit to Matt and the city and Raul and others, because we were literally going back and forth multiple times to secure this really important convention of doctors and surgeons. And that's the type of business that we want. And fortunately, we were able to come to an accommodation. So get ready for lots of surgeons and related fields in the near future.
Dr. Money.
Just briefly, it's wonderful news. Obviously, we're all super excited with the convention center being open and thrilled that you all are collaborating on this marketing. So it also works both ways. If there's things that we can do as well to assist during the process, let us know, because I know everybody on the commission body would be very excited to do whatever we can to attract these kind of high-level conventions to our city and keep us posted. And hearing this item, it reminded me, I had referred something last year to this body to discuss like the Futur Spanish Festival and bringing it here. I don't know where that left off, but I guess I'll ask publicly, if any of us has an idea or knows of a convention, should we be emailing it to Matt, sure, to you, to all of you? Yeah. What should we be doing when we have ideas?
Yeah, I mean, you can always email it to me and I can pass it off to the...
And I do have a quick update on Futur. So yeah. Futur is one of the world's largest travel trade shows. It's based mm-hmm. in Madrid. Thank you, Commissioner. I believe it was last fall. You helped connect some dots. We did meet with the organizers, and I believe you or your representative were part of some discussions over the last couple of weeks. And the idea is to, you know, establish a Miami Beach version of Futur, potentially, kind of like Art Basel, Miami Beach. So there are some discussions. We met with them multiple times. They're putting together the concept. Candidly, those types of events quite often do require significant local destination support to get off the ground, but it's something that is on the radar screen, so we'll keep you posted. And in terms of leveraging your expertise, your leadership, some of you are experts in many key fields of folks that we want to bring in associations and conventions. I know some of you have already played a role on that, and we look forward to kind of hiring you and potentially taking you with us to make those final pitches and close some business. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
I think Commissioner Sammy Lynn,
How large a convention
is Futur? It's
well, the one in Spain is huge. I mean, it's the third largest in Europe. Probably sees 60,000-70,000 folks over, and it's a combination of, it's got a couple of days that it's just a travel trade, and then it opens to the public for the last 2 days, which is a very typical typical routine. This would be significantly smaller year one. I think they kicked around 8,000 to 10,000. That's significantly smaller for them, but it
I was in touch with somebody with reference to the orthopedic conventions, and they can get as many as 40,000.
Art Basel does 77. Art Basel does 77,000. So
okay,
we can
well
do
that. Answers my question.
Yeah, we can handle it.
So just as a reminder, we love to get these, you know, whether it's the dermatologists or the orthopedic surgeons, and those every now and then will get a convention potentially 10,000 plus. And when I say convention, it's those citywide conventions that are contracting room nights in our Miami Beach hotels. Our sweet spot, and I say that in terms of currently, even with the headquarter hotel coming online, for us it's quality versus quantity. And we're looking, you know, if we can book on a consistent basis, and we will, you know, those conventions in that, you know, 4,000 to 5,000 room nights on peak, and it's the surgeons and the tech and the pharma, you know, those are the ones that we're primarily focused on. But we know that we will get larger conventions on occasion, and that's when we will be as aggressive and as creative as possible to develop those larger room blocks, not only working with Miami Beach hotels, our downtown hotels, and even beyond, because that's what it takes to bring those large-scale conventions. Those are great problems to figure out.
We're also getting a lot of last-minute business coming in from Fort Lauderdale, where that convention center is going under construction now, so a lot of people are being displaced from them, and so we're starting to specter. I'm sure the GMCB is getting a lot of kind of calls saying, oh, in 6 to 8 months' time, which is not kind of normal timelines. Usually they're booking further out, so we're seeing a lot of those kind of holes fill up on a shorter basis, which is great.
Between the first unsuccessful vote on the Convention Center Hotel and the second happily successful vote, I had asked a couple of times for the list of conventions that we had lost out on during that time frame that specifically pointed to the lack of a Convention Center Hotel as the reason that they didn't choose Miami Beach. I'm sure we lost other ones as well, but that was the list of ones that gave that reason of no hotel. And I think the last time I checked, it was around $130 million worth of mostly medical conventions. I'm assuming that we're going back to that list and revisiting our plans with those conventions.
Yeah, it was approximately about $130 million worth of convention business that had said that the primary reason was not having that headquarter hotel. That is at the top of our list. In fact, we're very close on some of those pieces of business, and they're all within the medical space, which again is really the core business that we're going after. So that was the first place that we went to, and I did want to add to Matt's comments. The hotel, the convention center, amazingly important, but this concept of the district is really resonating. We have some new dedicated marketing pieces that speak specifically, and literally we're using like a global satellite view and showing that we've got this convention center, we've got obviously the future headquarter hotel, the park that just broke ground, the Holocaust Memorial, Lincoln Road. And I know we're
the garden,
so...
The Bass, all of it.
The Bass, yeah. And we're so close to it. And not that we want to encourage our delegates to sneak out for golf or the beach, but we're literally, there's a golf course on the corner of the convention center, and then probably a 3-iron away, a different type of sand trap is our world amazing, the beach. So, we always try to straddle that balance between showcasing the amazing amenities that this convention center district has, but it's definitely more good than bad that it's literally surrounded by world-class facilities. So kudos to the team.
Right, because the organizers who are organizing it, who are the ones who are signing on the dotted line, just want to know about the convention center to keep their...
Right.
Convention goers engage there. So, I can understand that balance. Definitely. Commissioner, you were going to say something? Vice Mayor?
Yes, just that on your global map there, I hope you're putting in some of the new hotels that have recently come online and some that will be online shortly, all within walking distance of the convention center.
It does. In fact, on that map, it gives we point out the bookable rooms within walking distance, within 1 mile, 2 miles, and 3 miles. So there are concentric circles, which is typically what a meeting planner will look for. And then it really speaks also to this mobility and transportation issue. More and more, having the critical mass of hotels nearby will preclude not all, but some of the needs for these transportation networks that they're setting up. And I think that was a topic of conversation at an earlier CCAB in terms of the city's proactive role in addressing that. And we're out there communicating the various transportation options as well.
Great. I appreciate the update. I think it's a great time to look at everything with everything coming online and also understanding this is the main convention center for Miami-Dade County. We don't know what's going to happen with the other side of, the bay with the convention center there. It's not nearly the same size as ours or any of the Genting site areas or anything that could happen. So I want to make sure that we're focused really on understanding the asset we have and nurturing it in such a way that makes sense and the least amount of quality of life disruption, but the most gain as far as a return on that investment, right? That balance. So thank you so much for coming in. I want to make sure we're always proactive. If you have anything that you would like from us, or if there's any direction you need from us, or if there's any time that you feel that you want to come and bring something towards, shed some light on for us that we can maybe help move the needle on, or alternatively maybe help you say no to something, let us know. Come bring it to us, and we'll be happy to discuss it.
Perfect. Will do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We almost done? Let's see. Number four, Commissioner Gongora.
Thank you. Although it's got my name on it, I actually picked this up as a recommendation from the 41st Street Committee and put it on the agenda regarding their concerns about improving lighting in the corridor and allocating funds towards helping light the trees.
Good morning. Good morning. We've met with the 41st Street Committee several times, and we're in the process of trying to identify the type of implementation that they're, requesting and looking for. We're not there yet. We've given them some options. They've requested that the contractor that we use for the holiday lights and specialty lighting put together a pilot so they could see what it looks like. The contractor has agreed. We don't have some timelines that we're still reaching out to them and trying to figure out the material availability of when that could happen. In addition to that, we're working on some other options for uplighting. So we'll be back before the 41st Street Committee next month, and then we will bring this back to NCAC.
So can I just defer this for 60 days until they figure out what it is that they'd like to see?
Great.
Can you do me a favor, though, and really try to understand? I mean, are they looking – because when I first read this, I thought, wow, making it more safer and more light is always a good thing, and – but now I understand it's more decorative lighting.
I think they're trying to achieve both. I think they're trying to achieve more lighting, obviously for pedestrian safety.
Right, that's what I thought.
And more inviting, like you've seen on Española Way and Ocean Drive and some of these other areas. So we're still working on what that looks like. We just installed some uplights on the Palms at the Fillmore. The first time we've used those, so we're going to present those as well. So I think we're trying to narrow some of their options from a wider scale to kind of hone them in on several, tighter options that we can present before the committee so they can use that quality of life money to get this program done.
I was at the 41st Street Committee meeting where they talked about they wanted to put the white lights around the trees, similar to, I think it's Surfside that has it year-round.
Right.
That was what the idea was. It was decorative. It did not add to safety, but the idea was to make it more decorative so hopefully more people will shop and dine there.
Okay.
So the lighting option is that permanent lighting that we looked at this in previous meetings, Light 365, that's built to last in this type of environment. It's used in many other cities. So we're going to have the contractor pilot it, put it out there, maybe one or two palms so they could see it, nice bright white lights, and then we'll bring it back. So if we can defer it a month or two.
Defer it for the 60 days. But I want to be careful, to have decorative lighting year-round, then every area is going to want decorative lighting year-round, and we really need to distinguish between what's going to make it that extra decor to make it really nice and keep it active and safe also, additional safety. But, I mean, maybe it would be cool. We could pilot it and see, but...
Just to say it on the record, there was a companion item to this 41st Street lighting item that was more geared towards permanent safety type item and was withdrawn because I think the intention was to achieve this from this lighting program. So these two items kind of merged into one. That's what we're working through. But we'll go back to 41st Street Committee and then bring something back in the next month or so.
All right. You know what? That's great. Listen, they're working hard. It's a great committee. All right. Moving on. Item number five.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. Item number five is mine, and it's a discussion. It was brought to me by the Alton Road Homeowners Association. This is a discussion regarding fines levied against properties and what is our policy regarding when should the city move forward with foreclosure. The Alton Road, there's an attached list, and you can see it's quite extensive.
Incredible.
Yeah. The particular, there were a few properties on Alton Road that the Homeowners Association, has just become a chronic concern of the neighbors. One of the ones that they took me to, and I went and did a site visit with code enforcement, among others, and, one of the properties, they have... It was a residential single-family home. There was a fire. The home was destroyed, and that was 14 years ago. And there it sits in the neighborhood with no windows, with burn marks. It's really quite awful. And to think that that's, if you own the home next door to that or with any sort of proximity, that's having a sort of just a chronic quality of life nag on, you know, but also a property value impact. And so I guess the question they asked me that I didn't have an answer for was, at what point does the city exercise its authority over that? The particular property, that property that sort of for 14 years has gone unremediated. I mean, the city makes them have a fence because it's a safety issue, and it takes staff time to go and to check and respond to complaints because the fence, you know, is not well maintained and the landscaping is not maintained. So they have to keep going, addressing this property that the owners are not paying any attention to. In this case, that particular home has amassed, I think, $2.3 million worth of fines and interest from the city. So now the fines and the interest outweigh what the property is even worth.
Yeah.
So, you know, at what point do we decide enough is enough? Is, you know, if 14 years isn't enough, you know, would 30 be enough? I mean, at what point, you know, do the neighbors get relief? This particular property, by the way, is across the street from a property that sold within the last, I want to say, 6 months. There was a Fortune 500 restaurant chain that located their headquarters here, and a house across the street from this just sold on Alton Road for the record high ever was more than $2 million. And so someone invests in a home like that and has to stare across the street at a home like this. So I don't have the answer, but I wanted to bring it to neighborhoods for discussion and see what is the policy, do we like that policy, and get your guys' feedback on it. Yeah.
I love this item because actually I've corresponded with the city attorney's office on this question on a broader scale without looking at one specific property for quite some time because I'd never seen a list printed out, but it's millions and millions of dollars that we're leaving on the table. And I know that there's a lot of people that would aggressively pursue these monies on our behalf if we're not doing it. And I'm sure legal has their own presentation. And I know there's lots of reasons why they don't go after it because we're not number one in priority if they have a first loan and all these other reasons. But I think we should have a more aggressive policy if they owe X amount of dollars. Rather than just record a lien and wait till they sell or refinance, I think we should be looking at what's the value of the property, what our position is in priority, if there's money there, and if it makes sense, perhaps actually moving to foreclose on some of these liens. So I would like to see that, and it would bring in, of course, more revenue to our city.
Yes.
I was just overwhelmed. I couldn't believe the number. And some of them go back to 1997, 98, 99, and all through the 2000s. And as you mentioned, some of them are $1, $2 million. Together, it's a fortune. There's one that's $6,900,000. I don't understand why we haven't foreclosed already, and I'd like to, the attorney to please address it. To me, you sent a bill, you owe the money, you do it again. You do it again. How many chances do they have not to pay? And then you file a lien, and then you file another lien, and nothing happens. Why aren't we foreclosing?
Okay. Yes, please.
Hi. Good morning, Madam Chair. Well,
I was looking at Alex.
Well, I'm actually familiar with that particular property that you're addressing, I guess the number one, which is the $6.9 million. That case involves a dock that was not properly permitted, and it had to be removed. Unfortunately, the owner on that particular one had some health issues, but that case is still pending in the special master system, and so those fines are eligible for mitigation once the property owner comes into compliance. The property owner actually owns another property on the top five list, and he's gone through some refinancing and pulling out some money on some other properties he had to address this issue and then come into compliance. So one of the problems from the city attorney's perspective is that you have cases in the top 10 here that are still in the jurisdiction of the special master for whatever a variety of reasons.
Why?
After 19 years.
This is 19 years ago that
they
this
haven't,
was.
They haven't gotten compliance yet.
Well, why don't we foreclose? And they would wake up and say, oh, my Lord, I better put in a new
one of the first obstacles in foreclosure, as Commissioner Gongora indicated, was we're prohibited against any homestead properties from foreclosing our liens.
That I knew.
So residential homesteaded properties go out the window right away. Then we have to look at properties where there are mortgages. Most of these properties are not mortgage-free. So the ideal property to go after would be a commercial property or a residential property, investment property that doesn't have a mortgage. Those we could look at case by case under some type of system.
And just so I could add, if we foreclose on something with a primary money purchase mortgage, it becomes ours.
And we own it subject
to pay the mortgage. I understand that.
We have to use the taxpayer dollars to pay off the private debt.
We have initiated foreclosure proceedings in very limited areas where a property is such a nuisance.
Wait, did you say that if we foreclose on our lien and they have a mortgage, we have to pay their mortgage?
If we're the successful.
That's always first.
Yeah, we don't do that. I disagree with that. We would be subject to the first mortgage, but we don't have to pay it. They could just foreclose us out eventually.
Correct. But then we would lose it it depends
what. The whole point
on the size
of the
mortgage.
We do this in condo associations all the time. We're inferior to the first mortgage. We foreclose, and the association takes title, and we do something to make money with it. We rent it typically, and eventually the bank forecloses us out, but we never pay the mortgage.
It depends what we want. If it's a commercial property, and perhaps you know, finance wants to look at, buying it outright, because we've done on. Not on a foreclosure case, but in housing, when you have a restricted covenant and a mortgage for some of the ship loans, we've actually came before the commission to actually buy that unit and keep it in the affordable housing stock. So it's really what the goals are of the commission.
Okay. Yes. To me, the real goal of even considering this is not the revenue that we would get, but rather the reintroduction of a property into the viable market where someone's going to invest in it, remediate it, in the case of a single-family home, live in it, sell it, whatever they do, they're converting it from being a blight and an eyesore into a viable contributing component, of our housing market, of the economy, and so forth. And none of us would ever want to rush into this. But I'm not sure that I agree with what you said about satisfying the mortgage, because the ones that are particularly egregious are quite old. I mean, I brought up an example that was 14 years old. Commissioner Malakoff brought up an example that was 19 years old. Whatever that mortgage was, we've had a tremendous geometric increase in property values since that time. I think it requires further analysis to say, well, what are those mortgages? I bought my own single-family home on Alton Road in 1999, and my original mortgage was $350,000. Okay, so if those are the caliber of mortgages that we're talking about, I'm not overly concerned because there would have been some payment on that. So I think even if we could get them into a break-even condition for certain egregious instances, it would be worthwhile.
Correct, and that would be a case-by-case, look at the property, order the title examination, and even though there was an initial mortgage, a lot of people have refinanced and pulled out money, and they've gone up.
I think we should look, too, and it could be one of two ways. I mean, the city attorney's office could do so, but I know that there are tons of law firms that would be happy to do all the work, the review, do it on a contingency if they think there's money there after the mortgage, if they believe there's money to be had. I know that if you were to put out, and I don't think you have to put out fees for legal services. I think you guys just choose them. But if you wanted to go an outside counsel way and not pay hourly, people would look to pick up this work and do the analysis themselves.
Right. And again, we're not saying that this entire list should be addressed, because we do want to give the property owner a very healthy, amount of time to be respectful of their personal circumstances and to really give them a chance to save their own property. But at some point, I think we can admit it's not going to happen, right? I mean, there's a waterfront property, the white one with the black cone on the top. I moved to Miami Beach in 1994. It looked like that then. Mm-hmm. Nothing has happened with that property the entire time that I've lived in the city since 94. I mean, at some point you have to say, we should do something.
Well, on another tool that the city does use is take buildings to the Unsafe Structures Board.
Right.
And when there's fires, roof collapses, and things like that, they're taken to the Unsafe Structures Board. One of the properties here, the 810 Euclid, is because of a 40-year recertification because the property owner owned it, and the CO is an apartment house. He's allegedly gone back to the county now to convert it to a single-family use, but he won't let us get in there to inspect. So until such time as the inspection goes through, we can't close the case. And as it stands right now, the police are going in there to body cam it. That was the compromise. So we were actively working with the building department to try to narrow this list down.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
If I may. I appreciate my colleague putting this on the table. There seems to be something here that we need to pursue. I think that's clear from the discussion. For me, a couple questions. Always it's helpful to know. I'd be curious how other cities approach this. Are there other cities that do foreclosures, and how's that work? What has been the best practices? And the second thing is, what do we need to do? Because I think we'd like to see more action. When I hear 19 years, that just doesn't sound right. I'm not a lawyer, but just doesn't sound right. And is it a policy directive? Is it a resolution? What would you need to hear from us so that we could empower you guys to go at this a little bit more?
Well, Commissioner?
Well, we have to first also determine what, if anything, we want to go after.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
So I've worked at two previous counties doing code enforcement. With very rare circumstances, will the county or the municipality pursue it, only because it's not financially advantageous because of the mortgages against the property. So with that in mind, I think it would be probably a prudent course of action that the administration identify the properties that they want to initiate foreclosure proceedings. We could then at that point in time conduct an analysis and make a determination whether or not it would be legally feasible considering all the limitations that we have doing the title search, because all of that has a financial component that we have to factor in. And then we could advise the administration at that point in time that on certain ones, yes, it's a go, on certain ones, it's not. And what we normally do is we will always recoup the money later on, and it may not sound as immediate, but at the time that there's a refinance or at the time that there is a sale of the property,
Right. Yeah.
We are normally identified on there as the ability to recoup those funds. So while we may not see it on the front end, we do see it on the back end. But if the administration wants to go and say, you know, here's you know, 12 or so properties or 24 properties that we believe that we want to pursue it, we will then conduct that legal analysis and make that determination and then proceed at that point. If that's the will of the commission, it doesn't require a resolution. It just requires policy direction.
Yeah, I don't think we need to pass a resolution. I think as a policy direction, I know you're recording the liens and we collect if it's sold and refinanced, but there's a lot of money on the table. And, yeah, we have some challenges if it's homesteaded. Yes, we have some challenges if it's mortgaged to the hilt. But I think the policy direction from this body should be take a harder look, dig a little deeper, because some of these properties are egregious violators, or there might be money we're leaving on the table or opportunities for us to pursue this more aggressively.
Commissioner? And as you figure out, you know, how you want this to come back, for me, I would want us to focus on the properties that are vacant, mm-hmm. right? I know there's some really troublesome code scenarios that were described where the property owners are inside and we're having trouble figuring out how to resolve it. But for this sort of action, I think it's not as complicated if the property is vacant and has been for some time.
Okay. I'll move that.
I have a question. Actually, Mark asked a question. How many other municipalities are we aware of that have government entities going forward with foreclosures?
I could certainly look and check. I'm not off the top of my head. I only know one. Fort Lauderdale does it, because
okay.
I've reached out to them regarding one property that we were actually sued, and I had to do a compulsory counterclaim, and I included the foreclosure action and an affirmative defense of facet off because of the money.
Does North Miami Beach do it?
Pardon?
North Miami Beach, did they foreclose?
Not familiar with that. No.
Because I don't believe that North Miami Beach does. I don't believe that Surfside does. It's just very infrequently that it happens, only because it's a difficult endeavor, and most don't want to expend the upfront resources. I mean, we're by far a bigger city. We do have by far more resources. So that's certainly an option, and certainly we will look at it with the guidance of the administration. That would be great.
I think if you're going to look at other cities, really the only comparable one is Miami, because our real estate is so valuable and we're such an unusual community with residents and people that flip homes and have money and that don't have money. I don't think North Miami Beach would be analogous. Maybe Miami might, but I don't know. I just think I've thought this for a long time before you put it on and had private discussions with the city attorney's office that I think we're missing opportunities.
Yeah, well, Commissioner, we'll check Miami and Coral Gables, probably more the
Is more residents. People are. It's. I don't think they have the high level of spec homes and investors. I think Miami might in certain pockets.
Okay, mm-hmm. We'll check in that absolutely, and then.
Yeah, and I hear what you're saying, Alex. But put yourself in the shoes of a resident who lives and owns in their home, and they're a full-time resident, and they live next to a property that is like this. Put yourself in their shoes.
No, absolutely.
I mean, I think as a city, we're supposed to look out for our residents, and this is one area where we have really been ignoring real problem properties in neighborhoods, and it's affecting our residents. And that's the lens that I would look through.
Absolutely. But we just
I read an article about one nearby. I can't remember if it was Fort Lauderdale or if it was Miami. It was actually not a good story about I think whatever municipality had instigated foreclosure. But the problem was that there was someone living in the home at that time. We don't do that. If someone is homesteaded, we don't consider this at all.
Right.
And that's why I would encourage us also to think about and focus on properties that are vacant. Because even if someone is a tenant in a property, there can be all sorts of circumstances where, maybe the person has health issues or other issues. And, you know, we have our humanity intact. That's not, I think, where we would start. But I know personally of multiple properties that are vacant, have been for decades, are in no condition to live in. And it's not fair to their neighbors that the city doesn't address it.
And I think that absolutely, Commissioner Allman, and it sounds like it is that we're going to address the vacant, the abandoned, the dangerous kind of areas. So with that in mind, that certainly is a great starting point that we would look into.
And two things, because I think we're wrapping this one up. You might want to also do an LTC to us, because apart from foreclosing on liens, if we have homes that are just in terrible condition that are violating code, there's other legal tools available. They can pursue injunctive relief through the court to require property owners to take action without foreclosing on the liens. So I think there's also other legal tools available to go after these problem homes. But for this item, I would just move that whoever's listening, you take into these comments and move for a more aggressive policy movement forward.
I second that.
Okay, great. And I just have a question. would this be better, and I'm asking, legal and administration, to have it come back to neighborhoods or to have it go to finance for the analysis?
Well, I think we'd probably like to put together some sort of matrix of, condition of homes. Are they lived in? Are they not lived in? Amount of dollars owed. I mean, I was scanning through the list, of the 400 homes. There's only about 150 of those that are in the six-figure range. I think that's probably, rather than look at the, folks that owe $2,000, $3,000, we're not going to spend the money to go after those for foreclosure. It's really the six-figure numbers that we might have an opportunity. So maybe do a little bit more digging into it and come back with some suggestions to this body. And then if we have to get into the finances of when it's reasonable or not reasonable to pursue for financial reasons, we would take that to finance.
So, Eric, are you thinking about just identifying, within that 150 or six figures, which one would be the appropriate ones for us to pursue and have the neighborhoods consider those properties, and then at that point in time we would move forward?
Yeah, because at the end of the day, we can see, even on this list, who's got multiple fines from multiple different, areas, and with a little bit of digging, we can probably come up with a handful of folks that probably Good. Need some additional attention.
Don't forget seven figures, too.
All right, so how much time do you think you're going to need? Because this is going to take a little bit of time, I would imagine, you know, to comb through everything. And also determine which of these are legitimate, where has the city already been made whole since we discussed. You know, there are a lot of other...
So if we could bring
this
it back...
This is very interesting. I just, you know, I guess we'll have to see what comes back.
It is.
If we could bring it back in 60 days, I think that
sure.
would be...
Sure. I mean, you tell me 60 or 90 days, whatever you need to make sure that... Okay, 90?
90 would be better.
Okay. Yeah, come
it's
back
kind
in
of
90.
60 or 120, because we're not meeting in August.
So, you know, we'll come back after the summer. Take the summer to go through everything. And I guess Commissioner Alamans, the motion was what, to go through the vacant and or to let staff determine the essential properties that you would like to have further attention brought to that matter? Okay.
And the other remedies.
And whatever other remedies? Okay.
Yeah. And if you could also advise us as to, because it's not like foreclosing the lien is the only thing we can do for these bad houses. I mean, the city can pursue injunctive relief, get orders from the court requiring people to do things. So when it comes back, maybe also provide us with other legal options.
Absolutely. Yeah, I have on land use something about the very unattractive vacant properties that are sitting unfenced to get make sure they're fenced with proper, like, white aluminum picket fences so they're not an eyesore to the neighborhood. Perhaps fencing around some of these items that are these houses that are detrimental to the neighborhood might help. We could look at that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the analysis has to be done. Like, really, what course of action makes sense for us as a city government? You know, some may say some of the extreme options may not even make sense, you know, when you do the entire analysis through what the process would be and then what the actual return would be and the timeline for that. So, you know, let's be practical about this.
Okay.
All right. Okay? Mm-hmm. All right.
Thank
Good
you.
Job. Thanks. Item number 7. Review the Keep Hollywood Beautiful program.
Yes.
How about Keep Miami Beach Beautiful?
Yeah, we're keeping Miami Beach beautiful. You know, I put a lot of cleanliness items, and after speaking with administration, I thought this was a good opportunity for them to discuss a lot of what's going on in North Beach with the cleanliness program, because we're doing most of the same things that they are. The only other item that they were doing that I asked administration to look into that we're not, and I don't think administration is in favor of it, but they also have a Adopt-a-Block program in Hollywood, where private businesses kind of pay money to keep the street clean. And I thought that was an interesting component to also discuss.
So I'll start because it was originally placed under marketing and communications. So I did a little bit of research on it and gave Tom a call and said, Tom, I think this is more code than it is marketing and communications. So
but we're working together on it.
Yes, absolutely. So I worked with them and absolutely I did the research and I said it's the NEAT team. 100%, and he did inform me that there's a lot of movement towards the things that Hollywood is doing as far as involving the public more. As far as the Adopt-a-Block program, Commissioner, I don't know too much about that. I do believe that the city did something like this a long time ago, and I don't think it was successful. That's the a little bit of research that I have on that. But as far as the NEAT team and what they have done or plan to do, I will let Tom take that over.
Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning.
Good morning, Commissioners. My mic never works when I'm here. Okay, that's good. Good morning, Commissioners. Tom Curator, Assistant Director of Co-Compliance and Coordinator of the NEAT team, the North End Enhancement team. I think what I spoke about at the commission last week was like NEAT 2.0, and I spoke to people from Hollywood. I spoke to Co-Compliance, the manager from Hollywood, and they do a lot of, I think the nuances that they do, we're going to include in our 2.0, go into community meetings, do more outreach. We just produced a video that I'm going to show in like 2 seconds about the 5 common code violations. I think the whole thing is outreach here. And also, they do other little things. They do commissioner in the community. And I'd like to invite everyone here to join us in a future NEAT. That'll take that aspect out of it. Also, we're going to be going to community groups, speaking to them. We're doing a flyer on littering and also illegal dumping. So I'll show you the quick video, and if there's any questions, I can answer them.
Okay. Make sure you don't litter with those flyers around.
Take it away.
It's a public service. We started showing it already at community meetings.
Compliance Department. Code compliance officers monitor residential and commercial districts for potential violations of the city code and are responsible for ensuring compliance. If you've ever received a citation and wondered what you could have done to prevent it, we've covered 5 common code violations in Miami Beach to help you avoid these common pitfalls. Always avoid illegal dumping. Keep your neighborhood clean, don't dump illegally, and dispose responsibly. You may have a fabulous house, but don't be too quick to share it with others. Short-term rentals are prohibited in single-family and multifamily homes in certain zoning districts. If your house looks like the worst in the neighborhood, take action. Property maintenance and upkeep is required. Please keep your area and surrounding property clean, trimmed, and painted. Fluffy and JoJo can't run wild because animals must be on a leash when out in public. And remember to scoop the poop. While you're enjoying our sandy backyard, help keep our beaches in pristine condition. Glass, styrofoam, and straws are not allowed on the beach. For a complete list of the most issued code violations, visit miamibeachfl.gov/code.
I think, as we keep doing this outreach and going to community organizations and get the flyers out, I think we'll accomplish the same thing as the Hollywood Beautiful. And we don't want to duplicate our services. We're doing already. We just do NEED 2.0, and we should accomplish it.
You know, we did a great walk. You and I were both on it. A bunch of departments were that Daniel Vitia and I did together for North Beach. And it resulted in a lot of follow-up actions for numerous departments. But one of the interesting things also that came out of it, which I want you to give us an update on, was the New Times periodical box project that you ended up taking on. And that was something that, you know, I think of all the public workers that are out there, sanitation, code, et cetera, you know, they weren't really looking at the New Times boxes because those fixtures don't belong to the city. And they had really fallen in a tremendous state of disrepair. And just being out there with some fresh eyes, I think we realized that they needed to be addressed. And can you tell everybody a little bit about the project that you took on as a result?
Yeah, actually, we're working with them. We're continuously working with them. When we see things, we give it to them. If you notice, as you go around, not just North Beach, throughout the city, a lot of boxes were removed and that were in places shouldn't have been. A lot of them had graffiti on them. So we're working with them, and we continue working with them to replace them. Also, I have a backpack with paint in, so when I see them also, I paint it. So
You've got New Times green colored paint in your backpack? So how many New Times periodical boxes have been removed and replaced?
I would say it was over, like, maybe 20, at least replaced or painted over. Like, there's a few of them. And also, the stickers were taken off them. And the one you gave us, Commissioner, on Washington and 8th Street, that's been removed.
Right. So if residents see New Times boxes that are in disrepair, can they report those through the eGov app?
eGov app. You can call 305-604-CITY.
Okay. You're still working that project.
They're working it, but they're very cooperative working with us on that.
Thank you, New Times.
So thank you for putting this on the agenda. I love these items as well. And I also did a walk with the crew. And I encourage every one of us to do that, because what you see walking around any particular neighborhood is very different than when you're driving by. And so on my walk, I also had PD there. I had, you know, everybody, because there's so many different elements that overlap, and then there's some that are distinctly different departments. So basically, I love that we've started the NEAT implementation, and I know that we're going to start moving that around throughout the city. I know 41st Street, yes.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I know 41st Street is now, that area is going to have some of that. And so I guess this really causes us to raise it even to the next level, right? NEAT 2.0, as you called it. And so maybe this is something that we can get a quarterly update on.
Sure.
You know.
I think we have a cleanliness item
index.
That's quarterly.
We
maybe
do.
We can just wrap this into that one together.
It's also, you know, we take a holistic approach. We go to a neighborhood. It's not about giving violations. It's about just getting compliance.
Right. And I think I love the approach of what I witnessed anyway with the NEAT is we're not out there to cause anybody further agony. It's we want to bring this to your attention. Are you aware, property owner, that these are actually not okay? We're going to give you X amount of time to comply. And then you go back and you see that they've complied. It's not coming out from 0 to 1,000. It's letting educating the community as well. So, Michael, I think we're good?
Yeah. Yeah, let's just wrap this into the quarterly cleanliness update, and we can hear them all together.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I love this. Thank you, Commissioner Gongora, for putting it on. Thank you for NEAT 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, all good. I think what you'll see, and you're probably seeing, and my colleagues brought up, is that you'll hear requests from other departments, because we hear it from the neighborhoods. So I love it. I just want to make sure that, you know, some of the good South Beach neighborhoods are on the hit list, whether it's Nofna, Wavna, Flamingo Park, South of Fifth. They've done walks, but I think in cross-discipline, cross-department walkthrough with those neighborhoods, I think would be very helpful. And it's really a different way to deliver service. It's sort of at the neighborhood level. So I think this is a really wonderful idea, and I will happily join on one of those.
Yeah, we went to South of Fifth last week. We did a lot
Excellent.
Of work on Second Street. So we're on.
That's great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Madam Chair, I had a request by email on item 8, even though it's new business, to hear it next month to give the neighbors time to work with staff.
Yeah, I received the same request, okay. So I think we should defer 8.
Okay, Kathy? Okay. Or Eric?
Both of you.
Yeah. Just let it. Okay, great. Okay. Show number 8 as deferred. Item number 9. Discussing the concepts proposed in Alton Road from 63rd to North Michigan Avenue bicycle alternatives, analysis and implementation.
Linda Weston, transportation. So could we start with the video? Alton and Chase are very similar, so you'll see them kind of intertwined in the video I'm about to show you. We'll stop it before it goes to Chase, though.
So this okay, item number 9. Got it. Thank you.
So this shows the location of the Alton Road Shared Use Path and the Chase and 34th Street project. And they're going to start their journey at the golf club. This gives you an aerial view. And they go north along the edge, the west edge of the golf club, on the city property. The proposed Alton Road shared use path is 8 feet, with 8 feet of bike lanes with a 5-foot sidewalk on the east side. Now they're going north from the parking lot. And you'll see them get to the proposed signature entryway feature on the corner of Alton and Chase. And if you could stop the video, that would be good. And if you could go to if you could start the presentation. The first part of the presentation is about Alton Road. So that gives you an overview. Where did the clicker go?
Right.
Okay, the Alton Road Shared Use Path is a Priority 1 project in the Transportation Master Plan. The goals are to increase pedestrian, bike, transit usage within the city and decrease the use of single occupancy vehicles. Both of the Chase and Alton projects are Priority 1 projects in the Transportation Master Plan. You can see them both of the map. 15 is Alton, 19 is the Chase project. So a shared use path is adjacent to the roadway. It's both for pedestrians and bicycles, and they're mixed. A shared use path was proposed all the way around the golf course in the master plan. So we did a lot of combined outreach for Alton and Chase. We did direct outreach to homes. We did social media outreach. There were 3 public meetings. At the last public meeting, the community members did propose accept a design for Chase. There had been unanimous support for the Alton projects throughout the course of those meetings. The Alton Road HOA president was there for each of the meetings and was supportive. There were also 3 meetings in the field for the project. The Alton Road enhancements, this is the location again. You can see the typical section going north from the golf course. This is next to the golf course property. The golf course has been a fantastic partner. They've been at each of our meetings. We've had separate meetings with them. We've met in the field with them. They've been really great to work with. And that's it. That is an overview of the Alton Road Shared Use Path project. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I think what we were looking for was the recommended concepts from Alton Road from 63rd Street to North Michigan Avenue. And you were giving 63rd, us ones in the south.
I'm sorry. I didn't catch that.
Item 9, yeah.
It was interesting.
It was interesting.
Apologize. So from 43rd Street to 63rd Street?
From 63rd Street down to North Michigan Avenue.
Down to North Michigan
Item
Avenue.
9.
Yes. So that this was from Michigan up to Chase Avenue. The same concept goes along Old Alton Road till you get to 43rd Street. And then you would connect to the shared use path going on North Bay Road to go north. Or you could, there's a potential to go on Alton Road in the future. We don't have a rendering of that.
Okay.
Yeah.
You refer them to the
In our book we have it, right?
Right.
But we don't have an actual presentation to present to the public right now. Right. Okay.
And the portion on 63rd Street, we've had numerous meetings with FDOT. There's a separate complete street study from North Bay Road over to
How are you going to have safe path up at 63rd Street?
Right.
Right. And we're coordinating with FDOT on that.
I'm
sorry.
Working with FDOT.
I didn't hear you.
We're working with FDOT on that portion of the roadway.
It's a very unsafe area for bicyclists.
Right. Through the chair, I think one of the things that's slightly confusing about this is from 63rd Street South, we're really looking at a bicycle facility that's on North Bay Road as opposed to being on Alton. Mm-hmm. We've already presented and the commission has approved the concepts for the bridge crossings.
Right.
On Alton. So really the critical components of it are getting from Middle North Bay Road down to Chase, which is the old Alton Road section, and then the section south of Chase along the golf course.
Which was just presented.
Right. So we've seen the piece along the golf course from Michigan to Chase. And then maybe you could talk a little bit about the concept for the old Alton Road between Chase and 43rd.
Between Chase and 43rd, the concept that you see to the south continues to the north. It's a buffered bidirectional bicycle lane on the east side. And then east of the buffered bidirectional bicycle lane is a 5-foot shared use path. And that continues on the east side of old Alton Road past across 41st Street and along Old Alton Road up to 43rd Street.
But in that case, Linda, you're using what is currently a parking lane, correct? You're converting that parking lane.
There's 4 parking spaces in the piece between Chase and 41st Street that need to be relocated. We found a way to accommodate all 4 of those parking spaces within the neighborhood.
What do you need from us? I'm sorry.
We would really like you to approve that concept, particularly for the one from that she presented from Michigan to Chase and then from Chase to 33rd to 43rd along Old Alton. And as Linda mentioned, that does impact 4 parking spaces, but they have found a way to relocate those 4 parking spaces.
All right, what say you guys? Wake up. What would you like to do?
Okay. I don't have a strong inclination on this item because I was kind of reading it while you were talking. Uh-huh. Couple quick questions. Uh-huh. Okay, one. I'm not clear as I read this what this costs us. I know that they say that there's funds allocated from the geobond, so I'm kind of trying to, I was looking down because I was trying to mm-hmm. find that number. And then secondly, I was kind of wondering, since Alton Road is a state street, you know, why we are undertaking this financial responsibility. Is it our responsibility? Is it theirs? Should they be participating in this? Do they have to approve this as well as us? How does this work?
So I can go over the cost first, if you'd like me to.
Okay.
Or did you want to take the joint project component first? Okay, the costs for Alton Road from Chase to Michigan was approximately $3 million. From 41st Street down to Chase is $1.2 million. From 43rd to 41st Street would be $553,000. So that's, yeah. Okay. The project can go either as part of the Alton Road FDOT project, or it can go independently adjacent to the golf course.
Okay. Yeah, I actually got an email saying, yeah, okay, defer number 8, like you all said, but then that item 9, the bike path north along Alton, seems okay. Mm-hmm. So...
Is the administration recommending that we do this? Because I'm not going to micromanage a traffic and mobility plan for the city. Is this good for us?
It's good for us.
Okay, I'll move it.
Yeah, I'll second it. Let's just get moving. And but the one going further north is 63rd is not clear yet because it doesn't show the North Bay Road.
It doesn't show it yet.
Or any connection to North Bay. So that still is to follow, I assume.
Yes.
Okay,
that'll good.
And just so that... Since we're just, I'm going to wrap this up. You have direction, but just so that we're clear, we did get a notification since we brought up 63rd and Indian Creek that, I don't know, I'm sure you're aware, FDOT is scheduled to begin a roadway improvement project the week of May 27th, and the project limit extends along SRA1A, Indian Creek Drive, from 63rd Street all the way to Abbott, basically the most problematic area and strip, you know, in our north end there.
At least it's over the summer rather than the winter.
It's next week.
Spring. Okay.
But it's going to take 6 months to complete. So anything that we can do since we're on the topic.
Madam Chair, we have been working with FDOT on that project, among other projects. What they've said to us is that they... For that project, that's more simple in nature. It's milling and resurfacing. Okay. They felt that it's something that could be done either at nighttime or during non-peak times.
That was my main concern. If the permits that were given were excluding peak hours, I think we should be, I mean, it's going to hurt, but we are confirming.
They verbally told us this at a meeting with the secretary, but we're double confirming that.
Thank you.
And there will be an
And then
OTC
will we send out a text alert to let everybody know that that work will be taking place? Thank you.
Yes.
All right, we're going to move on. Thank you so much. And our last item?
Yes. This is a quick one. I assume you're going
to... The last item, right?
Yeah. You're talking about item 10?
Yes.
Okay. I referred this one. There was this great picture that didn't make it into our agenda, but it was all over Facebook of this cute fish that people were putting on the beach as a trash bin and a recyclable structure. So I just referred it because I thought it was cute for a beach town like ours as we move forward to try to do something interesting like this that might be fun and encourage people to throw their trash away in the right area and recycle in the right area.
Like a learning kind of live exhibition of what... Can you explain this to me?
Yeah, it's actually...
I love the fat fish.
It's turning a trash bin into art, kind of. It's making a trash bin something attractive, maybe that people will want to approach rather than something ugly that they're not going to want to go to.
Yeah, so we were kind of working parallel...
It's one of those things that it's very interesting. I don't want to stuff garbage in a fish...
So this is just an example of when we got the $300,000 for temporary art installations from the Cultural Arts Council earlier, we kind of started brainstorming what we wanted our first installation to be. And one of the things we came up with was starting to promote the resiliency and plastic-free initiatives of the city. That fish has made its rounds on social media many times. It's Gobi. He's in Bali. And I think what Commissioner Gongora is referring to most here is that it brought a lot of attention in a positive way to recycling, to plastics. And all we're going to do is we're going to put out a call to artists. This is not what we're going to do. We're just using this as inspiration. So we're going to put out
our first call. Like we look at Coral Gables umbrellas and we say we want to do
an
outdoor installation. We're just saying try to find something cute that brands us.
Okay, so we're not looking on branding our receptacles. We're talking about one installation that is art made from organic, reusable materials that also is that.
In a perfect world, we put out our call for our first temporary artistic installation to be installed right on the beach, which will be a plastic recycling receptacle, but will also be created by an artist, be Instagrammable, photographable, have Miami Beach on it, and it's going to kind of be a couple different plays here. One would be a media play on getting attention for our plastic-free and resiliency efforts.
Yeah.
The second would be if you watch videos of that, you see people will walk a few blocks to recycle to get to
that's
that.
Cool.
And
that,
I agree
no,
with
listen,
you.
That's
visually,
cool.
It's not my favorite, but no, it's a great initiative.
And somebody tagged us all, at least me, I think everybody on the commission over the weekend, that they were in Bilbao, Spain, and they were talking about all kinds of opportunities to turn everything outdoors into art, whether it's markets, spins, you know, playgrounds. You know, we're always looking for opportunities to make Miami Beach more interesting, and I just thought this was a cute one that would work.
Okay. Art is in the eye of the beholder, Commissioner Steinberg.
It's so subjective. Listen, birds on buildings and fish receptacles. All right, so what do you want us to do?
Nothing. We're just letting you know that we were already going this route with our called artist.
You're already doing
I like
this.
It.
It's already happening.
Love it. Kay. Go forward.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank
and
you.
That would be that's great. No, all joking aside, a statement piece that can have something positive for our environment.
And it will be adjudicated by the Cultural Arts Council to
even better
rest your worries.
Even better. So with that, I just want to say one thing. Kathy Brooks, this is your last neighborhoods meeting, and we're going to miss you on this dais. I know, Eric, you have some big shoes to fill up there, but, you know, we love you. This is not your farewell, but this is your last neighborhoods meeting. So thank you for everything.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. It's
thank
been a
you,
pleasure.
Kathy.
And Eric will be fantastic.
We'll miss you as assistant city manager, as budget director, and all of the different positions you've had.
But she's still
you've
a resident, so she's not going far. All right.
She'll be right over here.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Till next month, meeting adjourned. Have a safe weekend, everybody.
Thank you.